Okay, good evening, everybody. It's 9:07 on May 7th, 2018. This is our normal Monday night call. John is not here today. I'm giving him a break, letting him take a nap, play hooky, whatever else he's doing. But in the meantime, I'll run the meeting and we'll have some fun. So I'll start tonight with a Bible reading, as we usually do. I don't know if Brent is here, but if he is, then he'll pick up. But I got a couple things to go over before that. So let's get to the Bible reading, and then we'll work through some of this other stuff we have to do. And tonight I'm going to read Psalm 89, Prayer for the Mercy of God, recounting the shortness and miseries of the days of man. The Lord has been our refuge from generation unto generation. Before the mountains were made, or the earth were, and the world was formed, from eternity to eternity, thou art God, our God. Turn not man away to be brought low. O thou hast said, be converted, O ye sons of men, for 1,000 years in the sight, in thy sight, as are as of yesterday, which is past. And as a watch in the night, 5 things that are counted nothing shall their years be. In the morning, man shall grow up like grass. In the morning, he shall flourish and pass away. In the evening, he shall fall, grow dry, and wither. For in thy wrath we have fainted away, and are troubled by thy indignation. Thou hast set our iniquities before thine eyes, and our life in the light of thy countenance. For our days are spent, and in thy wrath we have fainted away. Our years shall be considered as a spider, 10 times the days of our years, and in them are 80 years. But but if the strong, they be 80 years, and what is more of them is labor and sorrow. For mildness has come upon us, and we shall be corrected. Who knoweth the power of thy anger, and thy fear? 12 can number thy wrath. So make the right hand known, and men of learned heart and wisdom, return, O Lord, how long, and be entreated in favor of thy servants. We are filled in the morning with thy mercy, and we have rejoiced and are delighted in all our days. We have rejoiced for the days in which thou hast humbled us, and for the years which we have seen evils. Look upon thy servants and upon their works, and direct their children, and let the brightness of the Lord our God be upon us, and direct thou the works of our hands over us. Yea, the work of our hands do thou direct. Okay, amen to that. So, the queue is open if people want to start getting into it. We've had a couple things go on. We're working this New York case that the judge answered, and basically, the New York gun case is in a federal court, as is our master case is in federal court. And there seems to be no difference in either case in as far as the judges want to treat this to bring us out of common law and into a statutory, proceeding, civil, everything is civil. You know, you go in and you fill out a civil cover sheet, and then the summons says civil summons. And so what they do is they put you in this chancery, civil court that basically denies your unalienable rights, and they feel comfortable doing that, and they feel comfortable throwing their statutes at us. So if you go on the NLA site, you can see that the writ of errors that we've issued to these judges in the New York case and in the other case. But what's going to happen here is each case is teaching us a little bit more about how they operate. And each time they pull something, we start to close the doors. And pretty soon, they have no place to turn, because we're going to answer them, and they're not going to be able to answer us. Now, the other side never answered our case. They defaulted. And what they did, the way they answered is they asked for 45 days in order to make a motion to dismiss. So they come into the court. We file papers as a plaintiff. They come in. They don't answer the case. They answer it with a motion for requesting 45 days in order to do a motion to dismiss to throw us out of the court. So we call them on that, and, you know, they quoted some rule that wasn't even in existence that we couldn't find as far as asking for the 45 days. We're of the opinion that you can't ask for time, for an extension of time or anything before you answer. If you haven't answered, then how can you make a motion on anything? You know, we've put a case in and they haven't answered. All they did was answer with, we need more time and we want it dismissed. That's not an answer. And so we basically slapped the judge, the magistrate, and the clerk, because all of them have violated our due process rights. Basically, that's where we're at. So we've decided that, you know, talking to John and trying to figure out, you know, what the next step is, we're gonna file what's known as an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court, but we're going to do it from the grand jury as a friend of the court. The grand jury is going to be the one filling the paperwork out, kind of slapping them and putting them back in their place. And as far as we're concerned, they're defaulted. I mean, when they wanted 45 days, the judge granted it to them. We said, you can't grant days on something that hasn't been answered. And they basically came back and said, yes, we can. So now we're going to do this amicus brief of the through the grand jury of the people that is going to outline all the things that they've done to violate our due process. And John has it pretty much worked out, but it's not done yet. And next week he will probably go through that in detail, because it's very interesting, the language, and everybody should read this stuff, because it's an education. You know, and we're educating the court and we're educating the people that are there, because they have no idea what they're talking about. They're just used to fitting, you know, things into square holes, square pegs into square holes and neat little boxes. But that's not the way it works. You know, we have to educate them about common law, you know, and the difference between fictional law versus real law. They have no idea. If they have an idea, there's definitely not operating under real law, under common law. So they've been subverting it, and basically, if you look at the paperwork and the paperwork that we're going to give back to them, we're gonna address every single point that they brought up, which they didn't bring up points that even, as a matter of fact, they didn't answer hardly anything that we sent them. They answered us statutorily, you know, off subject of what this case is about. So, you know, and the reason they do that is because they can't answer the law with law, because it doesn't, they're wrong, and they won't be able to answer. So as far as we're concerned, when they answer and they give a wrong answer, it's like they didn't answer. They're still in default, because they didn't really give a real answer. And that amicus brief is going to kind of explain that. It's going to explain what they do with their paperwork and how they're sucking you into their jurisdiction and then dismissing you, and they feel comfortable doing that. And we're going to do it, you know, through the grand jury, because that's where it needs to be, we the people. And, you know, and then copy the Sessions and President Trump, because this is all stuff that's coming down the pike. And Crystal had a very good idea. She used the president's executive order that Donald Trump made on the 12th of December to people that are subverting the government, doing acts of treason. And if you read through that executive order, you'll see that. It fits. Everything fits, because they're all doing the same thing, and it all goes back to the same money. And basically, you know, they are terrorizing the people, and they are doing RICO. And so that order, as a matter of fact, I believe we're thinking about using it too. using some of the language out of there and pointing back to it, because it's a lot of it is open-ended, and it gives an authority to work within the states from the Secretary of Treasury and the Attorney Generals in order to enforce that executive order on the state level, which is what the grand jury is going to do when we do this amicus brief. We're going to point back to that stuff. It's going to be very interesting. It's going to be pretty neat to see how that's going to fit in, and I'm sure that's going to get the attention of Donald Trump and Sessions and whoever else is up there, because we're going to open their eyes. I think they're already open to it anyway, but when they see the people paying attention to what they're doing and that we're actually running off their lead, so to speak, because we're using their words. Let me see if I can find that. I had it up here and I lost it, but deleted it, or it's on my other screen. But anyway, maybe I can get back to it and I'll bring it up. The language is very interesting. Also, we have another person here that's writing, taking that executive order and turning it into a common law document, which I thought was a good idea. But the thing is, to use it in a court case, unless we can get somebody else to make that order, and we're going to turn it into a common law document that people may be able to use in their cases. But as far as Donald Trump's executive order, if we're going to attach to it, we can't change it. We have to do it word for word. And then what we got to do is we got to show how the things that are happening in our case feed back to them. Look, we already know that everything that we were doing in the Bundys and the Hammonds case, it goes right back to Uranium One and all that stuff. I mean, we didn't know it at the time, but we know it now. And when you get into a lot of what's going on in these courts and with these officials and with these foreclosures, it's all the same team. It's all the same RICO, and it's all the same money. And I think that we can draw the lines back, and we can activate those executive orders right down into our own courts. And I do believe that they will be motivated and pushed to sending prosecutors to enforce those indictments of the people, and that's what we'll be doing. We're going to be doing some indictments on this stuff once we get it all flushed out and the language worked out, and it'll be very interesting to see in this amicus brief. We've never done anything like this, but it certainly seems that it's a strategy whose time has come. Anyway, I don't want to be too long. I don't know, Jan, do you have any announcements before I open up to Brent? We got any questions?
Do you want to take questions now before you get started? I don't see Brent here yet.
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
I'll take the cue, but if you have anything in there that they wrote, we'll do those first.
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what to do with this one, because it involves a case that somebody filed where they took our papers, changed them and submitted them, and it doesn't say what state or to what court they went or anything like that, and they got a negative response back, and they want to know, did he do something wrong, or is this just more judicial fraud, which I'm sure the answer is more judicial fraud. I can read through it, but I'm not sure you can get enough of a drift of what was done and what the response is.
Right.
You want me to give it a shot? And basically what he has in the question is the response that he got back.
Well, yeah, let me hear the response he got back. I don't know that I'll be able to, I'm able to infer for it, but I'll try.
Okay. It's pretty hard unless you're clairvoyant to be able to see it going and follow. Okay, it starts. I don't know if I should use the person's name. So-and-so has not filed a complaint, and what he did is he filed the basic show cause order format. So it was a show cause to this court. And the court says has not filed a complaint because he is proceeding pro se. He is entitled to a liberal reading of his allegations, even when such allegations are inartfully pled. Don't they love to stick it to you, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
See Haynes versus Kerner, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Rohde versus New England School of Law, da-da-da-da-da, and so on. Even with a liberal reading, his pro se pleading is not a complaint, and it fails to assert a clearly identifiable claim against the defendants, who is the bank and so on. See docket number one. In fact, the only reference to defendants is this guy, Legere and Kevin David, that are found in the case caption at the top of the show cause, apparently. Okay, otherwise, the pleading simply refers to the defendants. A generous reading of the pleading is that he seeks a judicial determination of his rights against WFFCU, some credit union, and a declaration that any foreclosure would be unwarranted because he failed to file a complaint invoking the court's jurisdiction, case number blah, 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 document 3 filed 5118. The court has no subject matter jurisdiction to entertain his request for relief. Sounds like they're just treating it as equity and not as common law.
I wonder, can you tell if he filed this case in the federal court or in the state?
There's no, it does not give me any clues there.
Yeah, see, that's a big that's a big clue because it depends on
and just says, I can read the starting thing here. It says, I use basically your show cause order format to submit a second show cause order for another home I own, which is being threatened to be foreclosed on non-judicially by the bank. And below is some of the denial order from the judge, but it doesn't say what type of court. I assume it's in the state of Massachusetts. That's the only clue I have.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty tough to comment on all that stuff. You know, in a federal court, see, if I knew if it was a federal court or not, I could address some of the stuff because
right.
In the federal court, you're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of the case. What you're going to get into is where they violated your due process rights. You know, they're claiming that he never filed a complaint.
Yeah.
And maybe
right.
He never did. Maybe he's taking their case number and he's putting a show cause on it like he's answering it, I don't know, without seeing the paperwork.
Right.
So in a certain sense, they may be absolutely right. You know, he didn't, in other words, you always got to have a cause of action and it has to stand up on those three legs of what make a good cause of action, and they're always looking for that. And especially in the federal court, you know, they're looking for the statutes that were violated as far as due process or something like that. They don't care about the nitty-gritties of the what went on in the rest of the case. You know, you're coming in there and you're making a suit that you've been violated. You know, your unalienable rights of due process have been violated. I mean, they violate you all the time in many different ways, but if you don't lay it out properly. And the other thing is, you know, the federal court likes to get rid of these cases when you haven't either gone through enough to even allow them to violate your due process. In other words, you haven't exhausted anything down on the bottom yet. They'll send it back saying you haven't exhausted all your remedies, you know, that type of thing. But, you know, the minute they violate your due process, that argument doesn't hold water. But they love to throw the cases out. They don't want to rule on a case against the state if they can help it, if it's a federal case. And certainly if he's filing it in the state court, he's probably, you know, I don't know. I mean, you can file a show cause, and the thing is you know you're going to end up in federal court because at some point as you're moving your pleadings through, they're going to violate your due process. But nevertheless, you still have to go through the motions of answering anything they gave you and protesting to anything that they said before you go into the federal court, you know? So, I don't know. That's the best I can tell is I don't know what court it is, so I can't really speak intelligently as to what he did or didn't do proper. You know, if I knew it was a federal court, I could give him a couple ticks on what we know they're looking for. You know, and if you and any time you don't give them what they're looking for, that gives them something to hang their hat on to dismiss the case, which they love to do because they don't want to rule on anything that can prevent them from having to stick their necks out on an issue. They'll take that out. So you have to be very, you know, diligent on how you file these things. So anyway, that's the best I can do with that. Is anything else, Jan?
Well, I see one that isn't called question, but it's a question that came in this afternoon. I guess it came in just before the call. First question is, how do I submit a question for tonight's call? So we should answer that. To submit a question for tonight's call, you send an email to questions, plural, with an S on it, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Now, the question is, why does NLA ask us to study the original Constitution of 1787 when, because of the Act of 1871, the Organic Act, we slaves have and continue to be raped by the D.C. Corporation, deep state, shadow government, Zionists, pedophiles, moot point folks? And that's an easy one to answer, but go ahead.
Well, why would you want to study any other constitution but the real one? First of all, you got to you know, you can't defend the real one if you don't know it. And anything they're doing that's outside of that is null and void. So if you don't know the original constitution and you're worried about what they're doing after the Organic Act, you're just, all you're doing is dancing with the devil, as far as I can see. I mean, I don't care what they say or what they believe, they're wrong. So, you know, it, like Brent says, the only cure for lawlessness is law. So you have to know the law in order to use the law to fix the law that's broken. So that's why we want people to study the real Constitution to learn their unalienable rights, so that when you see a fraud, and that, believe me, what they did with some of that Organic Act stuff and the Judiciary Act was to take a lot of our due process rights away, and that's exactly the things that we're going to be addressing in the amicus brief. So that's going to be, you know, we're going to go over that with a fine tooth comb next week. It'll be more written, and we'll be able to pick it apart, and it'll be a very good tutorial on, you know, those rights and the Constitution and how they relate to us in the court. But anyway, best I got there. Anything else?
No, that pretty well does it.
Okay. So
Brent is here too now. I see he just checked in. If you want to go to
ready
Brent,
or, he's ready. And
are you ready, Brent?
Well, yeah. I want to. If you can hear me, I got a fan running. Is it grounding me out any?
No, you sound good.
I don't hear it. Sounds nope. Pretty good.
Oh, good. That time of year when things are getting warmer. And, well, let me start by saying, yes, the only remedy to lawlessness is true law. And the comments I make here are my own. They may or may not be the position of National Liberty Alliance. Let me start with this, something that came up this week, and it's important because there are some people out there that are intelligent, kind, otherwise right-headed, and I'm sure we would be good friends if I had met them. Some of them I haven't met. One fellow in particular wrote a big book on the subject, a big, thick, hardback book, and the theme of his book is that the phrase in our Article 6 of our Constitution, supreme law of the land, is an antichrist phrase. It's a lawless phrase because it says that the Constitution is above the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. And I had never heard that till I read that book. He sent me a copy of it. It was nice of him. I sent him a copy of my book on the excellence of the common law. But I don't agree And I know there are a few other people that are taking that position now, and I see it more often. The phrase supreme law of the land is most of it taken from Magna Carta. And the phrase in Magna Carta, chapter 39, was in wide use at that time as a matter of the spoken law. And at that time, of course, our common law, it wasn't called the common law, it was called the Volksrecht, which means the people's right or the people's duty. Volk is, we still use the word with an S, V changes to an F, and we call it the folk right, the right of the folk, which means the, in old Anglo speech, right means duty. They have two words for law, and that's each of them stresses a different thing. And the word right, as we use the word still, means duty. And the phrase law of the land, of course, our Constitution attaches the word supreme law of the land. What it refers to is not that it trumps anything that God has done, namely the Declaration of 76, the two volumes of God's revelation, his revealing, his uncovering of his will to man. Two volumes, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, lex non scripta, says Blackstone. That means not written. And the law written, lex scripta, is the Bible. William Blackstone tells us that. But the phrase supreme law of the land does not refer to it does not mean that our Constitution is above the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. What it does mean, the phrase law of the land, take it from Magna Carta, what it does mean is that our Constitution, as a matter of common law, as a matter of that first volume, is the highest law, as a matter of the law unwritten, the highest law of process, not substance, not right and wrong. This murder is against the law. That's substance. That's not a matter of process. Now, if you're going to try somebody for murder, you use good process. We call it due process. The way things are done, the how, not the what, the how. And our common law is a law of process. And the phrase supreme law of the land means that as to the general government in sitting in Washington, D.C., this is our understanding. Our highest understanding is what we agree upon as the representatives of the several states. We agree that this is the way, W-A-Y, things ought to be done. And our Constitution of the United States is a document of process. It tells us how people get appointed, how, H-O-W, people get appointed to the general government. It wasn't written to restrict the powers of the state governments when it was written, although parts of it, a Bill of Rights, have been applied to state governments. And some of them rightly, by the way, the Second Amendment is inherently, and all the militia clauses bring the states in that respect under the, well, the responsibilities, the duties of our four militia clauses. That, of course, is applicable directly. But by and large, our Constitution of the United States is applied primarily, firstly and only, to the general government of Washington, D.C. And the supreme law of the land means that the processes that are used, the processes, the due process, the way things that are done, that are to be used respecting the general government in Washington, D.C., are laid out, our Constitution lays them out. How do you elect senators? How do you elect representatives? How do you elect the president? Now, that's laid out in great detail. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights, those fundamental duties that are laid out there are as a matter of a limitation. That's a process question, limitation on the general government in Washington, D.C. So the phrase supreme law of the land is not wrong. It is not an assertion by its very definition that it is something greater than the great lawgiver, the supreme judge of all the world, as our Constitution puts it, or our Declaration of 76, rather, puts it. I just wanted to mention that. There's more that could be said about it. Time has a way of removing us from the meanings, the meanings of words that were intended at any particular point in our history. And that is why throughout our history of our particular culture, there are solid stepping stones, documents that are written down. And in every one of them, whether you go back to, as we said last time, the laws of Edward the Confessor before Magna Carta, the Magna Carta itself, the laws of King Alfred before the laws of Edward the Confessor, the Molutine laws before that, all of those were, and then, of course, the English Bill of Rights of the English Revolution, and then our Constitution and Declaration. All of those documents are re-expressions of the same first principles of our common law applied as they understood them, the language they used and the phrases they used in those days. They're re-expressions of it. And we today have the responsibility to expound, explain, and re-express our fundamental understanding of process, of right and wrong, as how we should do things. It's no accident that those that founded our country, those that hammered out the Constitution of the United States and signed the Declaration of 76, quoted Edward Coke, C-O-K-E. They quoted him in their writings more than any other man to justify what they were doing. Edward Coke was the man that wrote the great commentary on Magna Carta. He was a justice in England of the days of James I, of King James Bible fame. King James jailed him, wanted to try him for his life. Why? Because he was a strong proponent of our common law, and he saw that King James wasn't. King James believed in the divine right of kings, and he said the law was in his breast. And he said the king protecteth the common law. And Coke said, nay, sire, the common law protecteth the king. In other words, the common law is above any man, including the king. Well, he wanted his neck for that. So Coke, he continued to write, and he tried to re-express, expound, and explain Magna Carta. And that would have been over four centuries after Magna Carta. Well, we're still doing that today. We have another document here, hammered out, two of them, the Declaration of 76 and the Constitution of the United States. And here we are trying to re-express what those documents mean by what they say. And we're now removed by better than 200 years, well over 200 years, and things have changed a little bit. Circumstances have changed. The use of our English language has changed, and that's why people misunderstand that phrase, law of the land. And then also, our understanding, the things we need to apply our common law to have changed, but our common law, and hear me on this strong, our common law, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature is God, written in the Bible, those first principles of law have never changed, never will change. I don't care what language you express them in, what phrases you use to express them to the culture in which you live. They're applicable to all men at all times, all places. Listen, here's one way you can know what is true law and what isn't. Just one way. There are other ways you can know. Just ask yourself, is this thing here that I'm looking at, for example, thou shalt not steal, that's one example, is this thing I'm looking at applicable to all men? Can we apply it to all men at all times, at all places, no matter where they are or what kind of good circumstances they find themselves in or bad? If the law you're talking about, the standard you're considering, is not applicable to all men in all times and all places, then it's not true law. It's not one of those first principles of law. You say, well, these principles of the Constitution don't apply to men that are locked up in prison for 40 years. You don't think they are? I would ask you to reconsider. Men that are in prison form their own governments. They can't help it. It's part of our psyche. It's part of our image that we have, that we're made out of the imagination of our Creator. That's what we mean when we talk about the image of God in man. That means we are a product of His imagination. And He asks us, and He tells us, I don't want you to return the compliment and make me in your image. Don't do that. Don't even make statues and pictures of God. But I did that to you because I'm your Creator, and I made you out of my imagination. And one of the things that He has given us, out of His imagination, one of the features that He has planted in us, it's inevitable. We can't stop doing it. And if we don't accept His way of doing it, we'll make up our own. What is that government? Oh, yeah, even people in the gulags of the old USSR, they develop in those places their own governments. In the dungeons, men develop their own governments. And in the prisons today, they do the same thing. I'm just making the point. Really think hard when you think about, is this applicable to all men at all times, at all places? If they would but apply it, would it be applicable? If the answer is yes, it's true law. If the answer is no, it's not. Well, that's just one way. Let's look at the Declaration of 76. We're moving through it clause by clause, blow, blow, by blow. We're up to paragraph number 22. And it says here that we're kicked off, the 13 colonies, that is. We're kicked off at George III. He says he's king in England, but he says he's emperor here, and we see the difference. That means the common law doesn't apply. That means we're part of an empire and not part of the common law England. We don't like that. So we're kicked off of him, chapter. They call it chapter. It's paragraph. Paragraph 22. We're kicked off of George III for abolishing the free system of English laws in the neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. Now, we've said that had to do with the Quebec Act and the establishment of canon law in French-speaking Quebec because they were Romanists up there. They still are, by the way. And then they extended the boundaries of Quebec clear down the Ohio River to take in all of Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, parts of West Virginia, right up to Kentucky, the Ohio River. And then we went through Chapter 23 for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government. That's an overlap when he says altering fundamentally the forms of our government. What is the form of our government? Well, it's a common law government. So what's the form of this common law government? People say it's a republic. Well, not fundamentally. It has a republican form, but that really only refers to one part of our government. What part's that? That's the legislative branch. Our Supreme Court has recognized this and said that, of course, our Constitution guarantees the general government in Washington, D.C., according to our Constitution, is supposed to guarantee a republican form of government to each of the states. What does that mean? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States said what that means is it means this. Did the state in question send representatives to Congress? If they did, we're not concerned and we're not to be concerned about anything else. Why? Because that's what a republican form of government is. It's a government that has a legislative branch. So in that sense, our governments are republican in form, but more fundamentally and more overarchingly, our governments are common law governments. That's what makes us different. It's not the republican form that makes us different. That's ridiculous when you stop to think about it. The collectivists of the Empire of France after the French Revolution called themselves the French Republic while their blood was running ankle deep in the gutters while they were chopping people's heads off in the reign of terror. The USSR was a republic. Why? They had representatives. So they called themselves a republic. China is a Soviet Socialist Republic. China is called today and called themselves rightly the Republic of China. Why? Well, they have representatives, that republican form of government. Doesn't mean it means anything, but they've got it. They send representatives. of course, in that respect also, we are a republic on the national level with our United States Congress. And each one of our states does have a republican form of government as to that one thing. But that's not the fundamental thing we are. The fundamental thing we are is a common law country. What does that mean broadly and fundamentally? That means that we have three branches of government and there is a separation of powers. Now, you could have a republican form of government, just have one branch, namely the legislative branch, and they're sovereign. And nobody can tell them what to do. And when you have that, of course, what you'll have is tyranny. And you'll have a dictatorship. You'll have a bevy of men that combine their will into one, follow the statute, and make you do it, whether it's right or wrong. Well, we don't have that here. In every one of our states and in our general government, the courts have the task. As a matter of theory, anyway, I know it doesn't always work, but we have the courts. The legislators can write the laws, but they don't get to show how they apply. And that can make a big difference. And the courts can say this isn't even constitutional. And the president, the executive branch, or the governors of the states, they don't have to. There's nothing in our common law that says, as a matter of common law government, that any of them have an obligation to do what the Supreme Court says or the courts of the state. And there's nothing that says that the courts have to enforce what the legislatures say in their statutes. And there's nothing that says that the legislature has to follow what the president says. Oh, they can if they want, and they often do. And the courts often, more often than not, do what the legislature passes. And the presidents and the governors, more often than not, enforce the laws that the legislature passes, and that they enforce even what the courts might say. The courts might say, I sentence this man to death. And it's up then to the executive branch to say yes or no, I'm going to do it or ain't going to do it. That's right. And we need to be saying that loudly because it's a fact of our form of government. Believe me, in Russia and Germany and France and South America and Vietnam and China, they're not going to do that. No, no. They have a republican form of government, but remember, it's a solidarity. There are no dissenting opinions in the courts of France or Sweden. And if there are, they're meaningless. But here, our appellate judges are obligated, if they don't agree, to say why, so we can read it. That's called freedom of speech, too, by the way. So there is a different form of government. I'm trying to get the point across. Fundamentally, most fundamentally, our fundamental form of government is not that we are a republic. It is that we are a common law government. That's what sets us apart. And one more thing to add. The people that are credited with inventing democracy, which means majority rule. Yes, it does. That's what they meant by it. And the people that are given credit for giving to the world the idea of the republic, those people are the Greeks. They didn't come up with it first, but they're accredited with it. They made no difference between republics and democracies. Everything was majority rule. They used the words interchangeably. I listened to a lecture by a law professor not long ago about the trial of Socrates. And Socrates was tried, as this fellow said, before a jury because they were so sensitive to things like that. And, of course, the jury was a jury of 500 men. And the conviction, his conviction, was according to a majority. In other words, if 250, well, it was 501. It wasn't 500. It was 501. So 252 people voted to put him to death. He would have been put to death, and he was voted. But that's not a jury. That's majority rule. A jury is all or nothing, and it's 12 men. Anything else is not a common law jury. Those numbers are important. Why? We don't always know why, and we can't always find the answer. But we do know this. What can we know? It works better than anything that's ever been tried in the history of Adam's race. Well, let me go on through here. We talked about charters and what a charter is. Charter, Magna Carta, means big carta, big charter. But charter, carta, the word charter is from the Latin word carta. It means white. It means big white piece of paper, just big piece of paper. It came to mean that. And a charter is a set of agreements or commitments, undertakings, promises, contracts. It is a widely applicable word to all sorts of writings of legal significance. Well, there is something here I want to talk about under that paragraph 23. For we're mad at King George III. We want to just get away from him because he took away our charters. What charter? The charters that the Crown wrote when they granted land on the eastern seaboard to the individual 13 colonies. And those grants of land usually stretch clean to the Pacific Ocean. Now, granted, nobody really knew where the Pacific Ocean was, how far it was, but they knew it was over there. So as a practical matter, as far as it really extended was to the Mississippi River. Virginia extended to the Mississippi River. You just take the northernmost point of Virginia, which would have been West Virginia at that time, the southernmost point, extend those latitudinal lines west, and all that was Virginia. And then Connecticut was the same way, by the way. Little tiny thing that it was, it stretched clear across. And the other colonies, too. They stretched way out there. And all those charters, well, when they passed the Quebec Act, just for example, as like I said, the Quebec Act, the Parliament, extended Quebec hundreds and hundreds of miles below the Great Lakes and clear down the Ohio River. Well, when they did that, that was a violation of the charters of all those colonies along the eastern seaboard whose land had been given to them to extend clean to the Mississippi River, really as a practical matter, but even further. And they said, you're going back on your word. Is it any wonder that the Indians said that white man speaketh with a forked tongue? Why? Because the government always speaks with a forked tongue, like a snake. I say always? Yes, always. That's the nature of government, to do that. Why? Well, there's so many people in government. One man says one thing, the separation of powers in the common law of government, it's up to the other branches to enforce or not enforce, or to follow or not follow. You see, it's in the common law of government, that's why you don't make deals with government. No, don't get wrapped up with government. You're going to lose. I can't tell you how many people I've known that were entitled to million-dollar contracts with the general government of Washington, D.C., that were thrown in federal prisons so the government wouldn't have to pay them. You say hundreds? No, not hundreds, but I've known a few. You just don't do things like that. You're just getting yourself in trouble. Now you say, well, I know a lot of people that make contracts with the government. They've gotten wealthy. Well, I know some of those, too. But as for me, I say I speak for myself. I don't think it's a good idea, especially when government gets the levers of power are more and more in the hands of men that are perverted. Clearly, you're dealing with some weirdos here. You don't know who you're going to be dealing with. Well, there's a lot of graft that goes on. And if you do choose to deal with them, I hope you come out of it okay. But we get down here, and it says that they took away their charters. And then let me back up with that a little bit and bring up a subject called diffidiatio. Diffidiatio. And you haven't heard that one before, I will bet. Diffidiatio. What is diffidiatio? Diffidiatio was an old common law doctrine. That's not an old English word. It sounds pretty Romanized in Latin to me. But diffidiatio was a breach of a promise. A breach of a promise between the crown. Parliament recognized this, between the crown and a person or a group of persons. Now, under the doctrine, the teaching called diffidiatio, the king's broken promise justified withdrawal of allegiance. Now, apply this to the American colonies, because this is the Common Law Foundation. There are other overarching principles, but this is the Common Law Foundation upon which they base their right, their duty, as the Declaration of 76 says, to withdraw their relationship from the crown of England. Because the king's broken promise, I'll repeat the doctrine again, the king's broken promise justified withdrawal of allegiance. But it justified withdrawal of allegiance only if his broken promise caused serious injury. If serious injury is caused by the broken promise of the crown, the common law entitled the injured party to end the relationship under this teaching of common law called diffi diatio. It's called diffi diatio because the word diffi diatio signifies a solemn and open gesture of defiance toward the king's misuse of power. Now, let me say that a little more softly. The softer the words, the more they have a tendency to sink into the ears. Diffi diatio is a solemn and open gesture of defiance toward the king's misuse of power. That's common law teaching. And this is fundamentally the reason why we separated from Britain. Diffi diatio is a right inherent in our common law ideals of limited government. But I hasten to add again, and I stress this, our common law did not allow people to break the relationship with the crown and remove allegiance from the crown. Nobody was justified in doing that unless this injury was exceedingly serious. Why? Well, because men, such as the king, no matter what we say about them, men are at their best, or as Ryle says, men at their best are still only men at best, and we need to give our leaders a break. They make mistakes, and if you were in that position, you'd be making mistakes too. So there has to be a serious injury. Well, isn't that a common law doctrine? There's no wrong unless there's an injury. But in this case, the teaching of our common law says that injury must be serious. And in this case, that's why the Declaration of 76 was written, to show, to catalog the seriousness of the injuries. Well, it was so bad that the Crown of England, using the power of the Army and Navy of England, most powerful, best-trained military forces in the world of that day, using them to burn and murder Americans. That's what it says in our Declaration of 76. Ravaging our coast, burning our towns, and have now sent the merciless Indians, the tribes among us, who do not distinguish, it says, between age, sex, or physical infirmity, to murder us. That's what it says. This is history. And, of course, all indication and all evidence we have says all this is true. Now, the French were involved in that, too, but the English were then got to pushing. Amazingly. And we know now from history also, it has been discovered, that the plan of Parliament was to infect the slave population of the American colonies. And by the way, in those days, slavery extended from New England clear down through the southern states. It was not confined to the southern states. That was a travesty, but it was true. But they were going to infect, they had plans to infect germ warfare, infect the slave population with smallpox, and wipe out the American colonies. So much so that George Washington asked the Continental Army to submit the smallpox vaccination, which in that day was not perfected, and they overdosed people, and a lot of them died. And they figured that 10% of the army would die. And this is one of the more amazing things about the commitment of those that supported the separation from Britain. The Continental Army all said yes. And you can read about it, how the men did it in sections, knowing that their bodies would be covered with scabs because they couldn't control how much of the smallpox went into the vaccination, knowing that they could die and then happened to take a month off each section as they vaccinated them to recuperate from the scabs that covered their bodies, and then they get out into the creeks and ponds with each other naked and try to rub sulfur into their wounds, because Washington said they may wipe out the population if they don't want to get smallpox, but if that happens, they'll have the army and we'll keep fighting. We're not quitting. That's the kind of resolve that they had. An amazing story. An amazing story. And that was voluntary, by the way. He didn't make them do it. He asked them if they would, and they all said yes. Well, this doctrine, called diffidiatio, according to the Declaration of 76, justified the English colonies to break faith because of the damage that the crown of England was inflicting upon them. And this gesture of defiance, key words, gesture of defiance, is necessary to break the relationship in cases of great damage done to you. And the instrument of defiance necessary under this teaching called diffidiatio, in this case, is our Declaration of 76. That is the document that fulfilled the requirements under the doctrine diffidiatio at common law. Now, for nearly 10 years, England had many times broken faith with the American colonies, not only according to common law custom, law unwritten, or common law, but also according to the colonial charters, law written in that case. England's Glanville, in the year 1187, he was the man that first set forth in writing the power-limiting principle our common law calls diffidiatio in the year 1187. And he said this, listen to him closely, "No person owes his king any more than his king owes him, reverence alone accepted. And if the king breaks faith, he releases that person from his obligation of loyalty to the king." Now, I'm quoting from this common lawyer, this legal writer, during the reign of Henry II. Let me read it again. He's the one that first set it forth in writing, or the first one we know. This is the doctrine, diffidiatio, that allows a person to break faith with the sovereign. Well, who's the sovereign here? Who's the government here in America? I think you can answer that question. We don't have a king, supposedly. But at what point is there not to be any allegiance? That's why the Declaration of 76 is dangerous. Dangerous to the government. It was recently read into the record, the Declaration of 76, read into the record in the California state legislature. As you know, there's a large portion, most of California, the land area of California, is trying and wants to be in a different state. Let me read this again. This is the common law power-limiting principle of diffidiatio. No person owes his king any more than his king owes him. Reverence alone accepted, and if the king breaks faith, he releases that person from his obligation of loyalty to the king. And indeed, our Declaration of 76 was no new idea. It had been around in writing, well known, since the days of Glanville in the 12th century. And it was upon the basis of this also that Scotsmen up in Scotland signed their solemn league and covenants according to the same principle called diffidiatio. So your duty of loyalty to our Constitution and true law is fixed. Repeat that. Your duty of loyalty to our Constitution of the United States and true law. It says supreme law of the land. That's true law. That's our common law due process. And your duty of loyalty to that is fixed. No, you don't have to take an oath to bind you to that duty. The oath doesn't add new to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That adds no new responsibility to anybody that takes that oath, whether they're a military man or a Congress, what does it do? It doesn't add any new duty, but it additionally binds you to the duty you already have. You have the duty. I have the duty. And your duty to our Constitution of the United States and true law is unchangeable. Why? Because the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God are the way God made the world. And that duty, that allegiance to Him as true and final sovereign is unchangeable. Isn't it amazing, the Declaration of 76? I can't get over this. It needs to be stressed over and over again. Those fellows were out on a limb. They, as some people said, signed their death warrants. And a good many of them had their homes burned down. They themselves were hiding in holes and in the woods and starving and cold. They lost everything they had. And they knew that's the step they were taking. But they did it anyway. And when they did it not having anything greater to appeal to. They appealed to the supreme judge of all the world. And they called him our Lord. And it says that in the Jurat of the Doctrine. They swore. When they put that in there, that is swearing by the greatest power you know, and that God that says that He is the supreme lawgiver among men, He doesn't allow men to swear by anything else, nothing else but Him. He makes that clear as crystal. If you swear at all, you swear by me and me alone, and to swear by anything else is an act of idolatry. Well, that's your duty to our Constitution. However, obligation to those in government ends when their hostility to our Constitution causes serious injury. You see, just hostility to the Constitution, just injury is not enough to justify this breaking, removing allegiance from anyone, any government. What is it? It's when the hostility to our way of doing things, our due process, our law of the land, when it causes serious injury for which you have no genuine opportunity to remedy. You read the Declaration of 76, that's why it was written, it was that gesture of defiance that teaching called Diffidiatio required. They did it, and they catalog in there how bad it was, and that's why they did it. Are those principles applicable today? We'll ask the people in the communist states if they would think they're applicable. I say as a final comment on this, as long as our courts are open, we should use the courts. And I say that as somebody who has been abused to the point where I wondered if that was even a viable option. And I wondered if it ought to be done. But I did it, and I'm still saying. Why? Because I believe after long, hard consideration and long, hard hardship, I believe that that's what God would have me to do. And I tell you that I believe that's true of you also wherever you are, as long as the courts are still open. And that is what I see in L.A. trying to do. However they're trying to do it, they believe that the courts are important. That's what I'm hearing. Well, I believe that too. But as I said before, my opinions are my own. Thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me to say a few words. And I'm back to whoever's got the board.
Okay. I guess I'm on. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello, hello? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you. It's kind of weak, though. It's kind of weak.
Yeah, I don't see my thing moving here.
Uh huh.
Can you get more volume, Gerard? You're kind of low.
Hang on. Let me...
That's better, huh?
Yep, that's good.
Okay. All right, thank you, Brent. And we have some people in the queue. not the least of which is the first is Crystal. I will unmute you, Crystal, in a second here. How's that? There you go. Crystal, you've been unmuted. Wow. It's 10 o'clock. It's not past your bedtime.
Hello?
Oh, maybe it is. We might have put
Hello?
This to... Yes. How you doing?
Hello?
Yes, hello. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. You just called, right?
I'm sorry?
Okay. Hi, this is Crystal. About the illegal foreclosures and stuff.
Yeah.
What we've been going to the court. And finally, I told you what had happened. The judge told me to bring the paper back, stating that I have the deeds and all that stuff. So I did the following day because he let us out. About, we left at about 5 o'clock. When I got home, after I bought the service that last Tuesday, when I got my mail, I had the foreclosure papers in the mail, which he didn't even answer. So I guess they have all this stuff free, you know, they had just sitting there waiting in the wings of the deeds that he gave me back in 2 months ago. On Thursday, they must have come to my house from 5 in the morning and put the foreclosure sign again. The judge said he would answer. He would send me a letter by mail. Till this day, I still didn't receive the letter. So what I did on Friday is... I went to the police department, and I filed a harassment, fraudulent, and illegal foreclosure, and I used the executive order of December 21st, 2017, President Donald Trump signed off on. Do no harm, elderly abuse, disabled abuse, perpetrating fraud, abuse of power. I mean, I feel like I just list them all, and I said, and these are all the things. So I have to pick up my police report, and I got a letter. I mean, I got the application. I mean, what was it? Also, I'm writing a grievance on the attorney and on the judge, and with the letter that we're sending it. So everybody's going down to the police department in this area throughout, you know, and we're following the same thing. So now they have to investigate it, but we have to start with our local police because it is criminal what they're doing.
So, Crystal, this is a complaint you filed with the local police?
Actually, it's a crime I filed with them. Yeah, that, you know, they're harassing me. It's a terrorism. It's criminal what they're doing. So they're going to, you know, they had to take the complaint, and they're going to do the investigation and all the attorneys and everybody, you know. And so, I mean, this, and I said, it was just like, everybody's like, why did you, they said, because it was criminal, what they did. And, by the way, till this day, I still haven't heard from the judge. I did go down there today because, you know, I was down at the courthouse, and I've got another a motion to argue or whatever, because I was helping somebody else on that. And I said, by the way, I was here last week. I said, I hadn't heard from the judge and his decision. So all of a sudden, the clerk, she goes, well, he didn't rule on it. He's given himself 120 days. I said, that's 4 months. So that's, you know, but I'll find out. And I said, matter of fact, I got to get it in writing.
That's it. The judge gave himself 120 days?
To answer me.
Oh, my goodness.
I said, wait a minute. They want me out May 26th, like less than 2 weeks. She goes, he's given us, he goes, he doesn't have to answer you for another 120 days. So that's 4 months.
And where is that? In his rules? What rules is he running by?
I have no idea, but everybody's, he's like the number one that everybody's really complaining of.
And so he's playing a game with you.
Oh, no, they're playing a game with themselves because they're the ones who signed up on everything. And, I'm going to put a counter claim against them, because everything I got is all in writing.
So what date did they say they were going to foreclose?
May 26th.
May what?
May 26th.
Which is...
20 days from today.
Right. Well, look at this brief that we're going to do, that we're going to file. I think that will be another paper that you can attach to and put into the court next week.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And okay. Gussie up. I mean, we kind of like the idea of the executive order that Donald Trump wrote because it fits in there. It fits in everything said. When you read that order and you understand the way he wrote it and what they're doing, and it absolutely is covered underneath that particular order. So it should be interesting to see what happens. We're going to put it in our case, and you certainly should use it. I mean, you already put it in, but you'll be able to put in what we file under the grand jury, which will be a longer explanation of why we're using that and how we're using it. So you can put it in as a amendment or whatever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So pay attention.
Because I gave that when I first found it. I gave it to the police department. I gave it to the clerk, the first selectman, the mayor, all the head officials. So you know what? It's just like I told everybody, file this and make sure you keep this, And there was why would you go? And then people, I said, because you know what? I said, look at how they came after us illegally. I said, everybody has a right to speak and say, okay, well, can I speak? Somebody has someone to answer to. Everybody does, And they do this intimidation to make us get sick, because people basically are afraid and nervous. And I guess everybody here has been watching the results of my case because they can't understand how this has been going on since 2014. And as a matter of fact, this one guy, he goes, well, you need to come in with our group, He goes, that's what I told you. They were going to put you on a short sale. And I hadn't seen this guy in about four years or something. And he goes, so where are you living now? I said, I'm still in the same house. He goes, what? He goes, how is that? I said, through Jehovah God and Jesus Christ. And I said, I've been learning all this stuff from the National Liberty Alliance, Because they got this group going on down here, and they want you to pay, I don't know, it's like $25 per month or whatever the case is. And
that's a local group there, Crystal?
Yeah, I guess so. They're from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, yeah.
Are they filing papers in the court though? What are they doing?
I guess they are, but before they will help you, before they will help you, you got to pay and sign a contract. So first of all, I'm not signing nothing, and everybody else, you know, because they asked me to invite people and stuff like that because they had a rally pertaining, supposed to be about me, and it's just like everybody seems like they're trying to ride on my coattail and stuff like that, you know, or this person that says, first of all, I don't even know you, you know, and I said them what I've been doing. I said basically I've been on my own for the most part of it when I go there to represent myself. But I said, I, you know, speak to, you know, I thank yous all to the NLA, you know. And I just run things by you, and if I, you know, and a lot of times I may not get through, but I said, so let me just try this and see. And it's just like when I first started and I got all my transcripts, am I a public servant? And the judge said no. I said, it's just my grand jury. He said, no, he's a grand jury. I said, well, you just committed a treason, and I would like your resignation. He told me to get them out of his courtroom. I got that transcript. I came back up again, and every time I go into court, this is what I do every time. I said, I swear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me Jehovah God and Jesus Christ. He goes, I didn't ask for that, but I say it every time because they never swear anybody in.
Look, if these groups would just file stuff in the courts and support each other, that would make a big difference. If they showed up at the court.
Well, that's why I had all the witnesses there.
If they filed affidavits and everybody that's, you know, it's good to get a mass action going as far as, look, if they're taking, I mean, it's this same group of lawyers taking everybody's house.
Exactly.
That alone needs to be investigated right there. That sounds like RICO. And if the people don't stick together, you know, you go out there alone and they beat you up and nobody's watching.
But see, this is what we're doing today. 12 people, you know, everybody's like, well, wait a minute, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm following my complaint, you know, so they're all following through. As a matter of fact, the funny thing, when I went to my police department last Friday, and he saw me go, oh, my God, because they were very cordial, and the chief of the police, they all have the information, you know. And when I went there, they were all very, very cordial. And they said, okay. So the sergeant came down. He's like, oh, my God, you got all those papers. I said, it's not as bad as it looks. And so I went through the whole thing. So I started backwards, and I said, you do know what a warranty deed is. And he goes, well, yeah, I think so. So I said, let me go backwards. So I showed him, you know. I said, you see, this is my brother's property, da-da-da. And I said, and she quick claimed it over to us. We gave her life use, and when my mother died, we filed her death certificate, and we all became the remaining owners. And the warranty deed went in our names. We're the sole owners. He goes, oh, okay. So I said, now, he goes, all right. So I said, now I'm moving forward. I bought my property on such and such a date. And I said, and here's where they fraudulently three times changed over the mortgage, and it's MERS. That's when they scan your name. I never signed. There's no date behind that. So I said, I'm following through on that. And I said, but I did end up paying the property off in 2011. I said, in 2014, this attorney, along with this GE, put their names on my property, perpetrating the fraud I never signed off. I said, a week later, they put me in foreclosure. I said, they wanted to extort $7,000 before December 1st, before 12 o'clock. I got the money, but right before 12 o'clock, I took the money out of that account. I said, I got that receipt on that. I said, then he sent me a letter. They're going to do a short sale on my property on December 14th. When I went to the court, I said, I never signed a letter or nothing. I said, show me your proof and show me the contract. I said, you're perpetrating a fraud. On December 16th, 2014, they withdrew. So I said, and then on the same document, 2000. 18, on January 18th, they withdrew. I said, so every time they withdrew, I said, then they turned around and made up their own excuse. So I said, but the good thing of it is, this is criminal, and it's all in writing. And here's all their exhibits. So I'm going to file criminal charges on these attorneys. And so that's what they're all doing down here now. You know, so they have to do an investigation. I'm sorry?
Yeah, and if you had an attorney general that was worth his salt, that's the work that he should be doing instead of sticking up for the state government all the time.
Oh, well, guess
the
what?
The attorney that's general should be sticking up for you. He should be going after these attorneys.
Well, guess what?
Unlawful
we are
practices.
We're all sending, doing the letters on these attorneys and the judges. And as a matter of fact, it's the same judges. So they all have to follow through on the police complaint. And there's even some policemen and everybody else is joining the ship on it because everybody's, matter of fact, the funny thing, the one who was doing my report, he goes, wait a minute, they did this to me too. He goes, well, how, I says, well, we'll deal with you another day. But
well,
it's waking people up, so that's good.
Yeah, well, that's the main thing. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
You're still standing, Crystal. God bless you. And stay tuned for next week. I hope that we'll have something that you can add to your pile there to put into the court.
What
and,
about the complaints with these attorneys and judges down here? Do we need to send those copies to you, too?
Well, have you been sending them to us?
No, wait a minute. When I get these reports, I'm going to send them to you, okay? Because
yeah,
I think it should be ready
yeah.
this week, okay? I'll make sure you get those.
Right. Okay, very good.
Okay.
And hopefully we'll have something more for you to put in there. Okay, thanks, Crystal.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. And last but not least is California Fred. Go ahead, Fred.
Hey, you woke me up.
Yeah, you sound too chipper to have been sleeping. Go ahead. I think we woke Crystal up, though. It took her a little while to get going there.
Yeah. Oh, I was listening to your deal with the Anons, QAnon.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really had was a question for Brent, and you might want to listen in, too.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Is Brent around?
I think he's still there. He usually keeps his ears on.
Well, I'd hate to come between him and his pizza.
I'm here. I'm here, Fred.
Yes, sir. Well, I may have asked this question before or whatever, but I don't know if I did because I've been talking about this so much to everybody I know. That is that the Congress writes laws, and then the agencies take the areas, the gray areas, and they write what they call guidance. Are you aware of what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, now in the guidance that they write, it is not law written by Congress. So it has
right.
no weight, no value, nada, zero zip, nada. It's nothing but a bunch of BS that somebody took the time to confuse the public with.
Uh-huh.
And the IRS in particular uses their, quote, guidance to railroad people and treat it as though it's law.
Uh-huh.
Now,
yes.
Not only that, but these two runaway rogue attorneys, you know, Wiseass and Mueller, Wiseman, yeah. I think these guys should be disbarred. I don't see how these criminals can still have badges because they're going way beyond the prosecutor book.
Uh-huh.
I believe, as I was listening to this, there is a book that the Department of Justice puts out that's a guide for the prosecutors. It's a prosecutor book. And it spells out what duties they have and what they're supposed to do and not supposed to do. And these criminals are going way beyond what is in the prosecutor book.
Uh-huh.
They are actually inventing information, and they're not using information that would clear a person.
Yes.
Anyway, I guess I've made a lot of statement and no question.
That's right. That's okay, Fred. That way I can just relax and listen. But if you did have some, if you want to know what I thought about something, I'd be glad to say. But other than that, that's okay. That's all
I
right.
have one more comment that I'd like to make. Earlier, you said that as long as the courts are open, I'd like to use them. I would like to remind you, sir, that the last time I heard that quote was in regards to someone being hung around 1870.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Well, send me the site if you find it or the article.
Let me paint the background and then I'll leave you go. What it was is a guy was going to be hung, and they said as long as the common law courts are open, we're not going to have a military tribunal, and the man was saved from hanging by going to court.
That might have been the Milligan case.
Yeah, I knew you'd know. But the thing here, the key word is common law court, not courts are open. See, we have the same problem today. We have these Nisi Prius courts, I've heard them called, administrative justice.
Well, all of our courts, regardless of what anybody says, all of our courts in America that are part of the judicial branch are common law courts. Now, whether or not they follow the process, the common law, whether or not they give you a real trial by jury, that's another question. But the tools are all there to do it. Throughout our history, for hundreds of years, courts have not been, the common law courts have not always followed our common law. What is common law? Due process. That means the notice, an opportunity to be heard, handling of the 12-man jury. From that are your neighbors from the district, as our Constitution says, the district already pre-established. All these things are, there's much involved in what our common law is. And the amazing thing about our common law is that even when you don't follow all the rules just right, and by the way, there has never been a common law trial that followed all the common law rules just right. Never has been. But amazingly, still, if the common law is followed, you can still get the truth out and the right thing can happen. And that's what we count on here, substantial justice in America. We're not seeking for precise justice, and we're not trying to parse everything and make everything hyper-detailed. If we are, we won't even get the justice. Men are capable of such things. That's what the law of the city is about, hyper-detail, perfection, elegance, perfect equations, written trials. There's no fight. There's no down and dirty. Let's slug it out. Let's have battle by trial. That's what we do here in America. That's very much different. I know there are problems with the system, and I know that there always will be. I know there always has been. That has never changed. That's the beauty of our common law. It's resilient. And I say that as somebody that's seen stacked juries, clearly stacked juries, deliver the truth. I've seen it happen because our common law is resilient against mistakes. It can be. So that's why I say to say we don't have common law courts is blatantly untrue. Now, if you say we don't follow the common law in our courts, well, that's blatantly true. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes it doesn't happen at all. That's why we have litigants and lawyers. It's their duty to demand it over and over and over again. And every time you do that, every time you point out the error of the court, and the prosecutor or the lawyers on the other side laugh at you, just remember, they're piling up wrath against the day of wrath. And in that process of you asking, of you saying it, you're acting as of the prophets of old. All you're doing is telling people, here's what the law says, and you're not doing it. That's what the prophets did. They said, here's what the law says, and I'm looking at you, you're not doing it. You're not following the process that God has given us. And if you don't straighten it up, you're doomed. Sometimes, most of the time, they just came on the scene and said, you're doomed. The line has been drawn, and the hammer is going to drop. It's too late, boys and girls. Well, that's what when people go into court, by the way, the oath of our common law, to defend our law of the land, that's our Constitution, lays out the law of the land, says, to defend it against enemies foreign means willingness to pick up a deadly weapon and defend our land. That's what that means. Enemies foreign, enemies domestic means that you're willing to serve on the jury and uphold the law of the land. What is the law of the land? Again, it's due process. It is our common law. That's what our common law is. It's a process-oriented law, not a result-oriented law. And we have a two-part duty as Americans to be willing to defend it from foreign aggression, the law of the land, and to defend it domestically in the courts. And every time a litigant goes into court and says, this ain't right, our due process demands this, and our law demands this, every time you do that, and every time judges, jurors, or prosecutors, every time they laugh at you, every time they shine you on, every time they come at you with their teeth bared and do the vicious thing, make fun of you, abuse you, every time they do that, they're piling up wrath against the day of wrath, and you are doing your duty. And there's great fulfillment in doing your dirty duty. No, your duty. And I know lawyers that have gone to court and done that for years. And when the end finally came and they had to leave this veil of tears, they had nothing. I've known men that have done that. I've watched them. And I've known other people that have stuck to the truth all their lives, and they didn't have much of material possessions when it was all over either. But something they did have was the great satisfaction of knowing that they, in their own quiet and humble way, and I don't mean in an ugly way, in their quiet and humble way, they just said, no, that ain't right, and I don't consent. That's what our Maker wants out of us. And that is the highest duty that any man has, is to simply do what God tells him to do. And when others are abusing you and your jurisdiction, your responsibilities before God, and you try to stop them in the way that God says to try to stop them, and he tells us how to do that. Trouble is, we don't know those methods that well because we don't pay that much attention to what he tells us. It's that simple. But if we did, we'd be comfortable and confident, more confident, to just say, no, I'm translating now, enjoying it very much. I've been wanting to do this for years. I'm translating through the Aramaic section of Daniel. And that's a little more difficult because it's not much the Old Testament's written in Aramaic. It's very much like Hebrew with some differences. But I happen to be in chapter 3 of Daniel. And the three Hebrew boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the emperor said, when you hear the sound of the sackbut and the bagpipe and the harp and the flute and the sound of music, then everyone within the hearing of that sound must fall down, and the word means kiss the dirt. It doesn't mean bow. It means kiss the dirt. Prostrate yourself, face down. Everyone must do that toward the golden image, the golden statue of me that I have set up. Well, these three Hebrew boys, these three Israelites, wouldn't do it. And they said, well, if we do that, by the very act of obedience to what the government says, we have to disobey what God says. Now, you can obey government and not have to disobey God necessarily. And there's a lot of things government tells us to do that we can easily do without disobeying God. We may think it's stupid, it may be wasteful, it may be empty, it may be dumb, it may be counterproductive, but still, you can do it and not directly disobey God. But in those cases where obedience to government constitutes, by that very act of obedience, disobedience to the true lawgiver, that's where you got to start thinking about, now what am I going to do? And that's what these three Hebrew boys faced. They faced the situation where bowing down to this statue is disobedience to their true lawgiver. And they told the emperor, we're not soft about answering you in this matter. You do what you got to do. We're going to do what we're going to do. And he said, the text says he screwed his face up. That's why I'm enjoying reading the translation, because the Aramaic is more picturesque even than the English. And the English is pretty clear, but it's more picturesque. He screwed his face up and he said, who will deliver you from my entanglement, what I've entangled you in? I'm the mighty government. And they said, well, whether you were disentangled from this or not, we're still not going to bow down. Oh, was he ticked. And he commanded, yes, he got so mad, he commanded them, the men that ran the furnace, to heat it up 7 times hotter than ever been before. It was so hot that the soldiers that he told to throw into the door of the furnace, they perished. Well, the point of the whole story, you go read it, Daniel chapter 3, is that the true lawgiver delivered them. And you can see how that worked out. But I'm thinking, as I'm translating through this, things haven't changed. The state keeps forcing us, trying to force us to do things. I was just thinking the other day, the significance of the oath. To swear to anything other than the God of creation is idolatry. What is idolatry? Well, it's the same thing these three Israelite boys faced, bowing down to a mere created thing, whether it be a living created thing or a dead one, like that statue. Of course, bowing down to that statue was also, that was dead, couldn't see, couldn't hear, couldn't smell, couldn't taste. But by doing so, you're also bound, in that case, they were bowing down to the government and to living men and a living man. But things haven't changed. The government still wants to kowtow. For example, you swear an oath. We had Crystal. She said every time she swears an oath, she says the truth, nothing but, so help me God and Jesus Christ. Well, that's biblical. Why? Well, because God's law forbids you to swear an oath without swearing only to him. Why? Calling him in to wreak his vengeance upon you if you don't keep your oath, if you don't live by it. And to call anything else in, such as bowing down to a statue, such as swearing. Here's a good one. Try this. I swear under the penalties of perjury. Well, who are you swearing to when you say that? You're swearing that you're asking the state to come in and visit its penalties of perjury on you if you ain't telling the truth? That's exactly what that is. If you're not thinking to yourself, if you're not truly swearing to the maker of heaven and earth, you are an idolater. And God doesn't like that. Matter of fact, he'll bring consequences on you for doing that. He promises to. Do I believe his promises are true? Do I believe that what he says he'll do in response to disobedience to him will happen? Yes, I do. And I do it on the best of evidence, overwhelming evidence in history. Written in the scriptures, in out of the scriptures, and in our law. I've seen it over and over and over. Let's get serious about this. You can't do what's right after God puts a certain amount of vengeance on you. He can do a lot of things, and he does. He does kill men. Yes, he does. How do I know? It's clear. Paul the Apostle says that is something I take, and you must take judicial notice of. What? Well, this, he says, Romans chapter 1, the wrath of God is now presently. That's what that present tense there means. It means continuous action. Is now presently being revealed from the skies against all ungodliness of men who hold the truth but disobey anyway. He says the wrath of God is now being revealed right now as I speak. How else do you explain? Well, of course, that's what it says. I don't need to explain it. And burdens on somebody else to say it's not true, but I see it. And we should be humble before our God and walk with him humbly, because it could happen to any of us. We're all weak, and we depend upon him to preserve us. Well, that's the situation with going into court, and as I see it, Fred, for what it's worth, and I just gathered my gathered knowledge about the subject, all of us have a duty to demand what is right, and to demand it to those that are in positions of power, and to keep demanding it according to our law. The only remedy to lawlessness is true law. And if you don't say what true law is, if you don't say there's an injustice here, you may not be the smartest person, the most educated person, the most informed about the details of the law and the IRS code, but stealing is stealing. Do you need to know something else more than that? Answer, no, you really don't. You might learn more about the application of it, but when it happens, you need to say it. Somebody's getting their house stolen by usurers. Usurers, that's what bankers are, according to God. A usury was against the law in our English-speaking world until Cromwell in the 1600s. You can read about it in Magna Carta. It was called the scourge. Usury was called the scourge of all mankind. Is it any wonder that bankers have never been like people? Why? Because they're vermin. What did Andrew Jackson say about them? Go read it. What did Justice Story say about them? What did Daniel Webster say about them? What did a lot of lesser-known people say about them? They were just saying what people could clearly see somehow. All the money gets into their hands, and then we're dominated and we're destroyed, and then the wrong people have the power. That's why usury is against the law. But we allow it to go on, and then we wonder why we're having problems. Oh, I'm just here. I have a duty. I know it's against the law. I can see it's been against the law as a matter of common law for centuries. I can read what the common lawyer said about usury. I can read what God says about it directly in his written revelation over and over and over. I see the Savior of mankind. It says he lashed together. That means he joined cords. He spliced them together. And he went into the temple in Jerusalem, and he physically drove the money changers. What's a money changer? That's a usurer. He's a man that wants to shuffle money and get a surcharge on top of it just for the shuffling of the money. He drove them out. And there's a lot of stories historically what that means there. But he was driving the usurers out. He said, get out of here. He turned their tables over. He physically, they were afraid of him. He drove them out. I'm not saying we should do that. Well, I'm not God reduced to the span of a man like he is. Still is, by the way. He's God in human flesh. Not in human flesh. He is God of human flesh. That's a better way to say it. The blood of God, even, as it says in Acts. He is a member of the Godhead. He is the manifestation of God that we understand the best because he's like us. He's a brother, born of woman. And he said it's wrong. Why wouldn't I say it's wrong? Is there something, am I intimidated not to say, well, no, usury is wrong. That's what's destroying us. The bank said, isn't it obvious at this point that after what happened in 2008, and now they're trying to steal people's houses? Believe me, it's taking widows' houses, as Jesus Christ said. You steal, you devour widows' houses. Speaking to the Jews, the leaders of Babylonian Judaism of his day, you're devouring widows' houses. You're wrong. No wonder they went after him and killed him. Of course, I understand, too, no man took his life from him. He came to die, but that's part of the fascination of how he got to that point, knowing that was what was going to happen to him. But all of this comes back to this ugly thing we call law-breaking. What is law-breaking? To put it in old Anglo-Saxon, they had a nice three-letter word for law-breaking. We kick it around, but we need to stop and say, what is it? The word is sin, S-I-N. That's the old Anglo word for law-breaking. Every time you hear the word sin, you just should substitute law-breaking of law or law-breaking. Sinning is breaking of law, and sin is law-breaking. And that's what God has come in human flesh to reestablish in us, in his people, the power to do his law, his will. And usury is a big part of that. To understand what that is, it will destroy a country, it will destroy ours, and it's moving in that direction. Well, that's enough, Fred. I appreciate your paying attention to what calling in and then making comments. That's what I would have to say about it right now. Back to you,
Gerard. I have a question then. Okay.
Oh, yes, Fred. Go ahead, Fred.
You know, these people, how they swear on a Bible to tell the truth, blah, blah, blah. Why can't you bring in a Quran or a book of the devil and throw that down and say, look, you Satan worshippers, do your oath on this so I know you're not lying, and then kick the dust off your feet and walk out of the damn empire.
Now, I'm sorry, Fred, but I hit a button and I could only heard the first and the last of what you said. I can fill in the middle, probably what you said, but you were talking about the courtroom. That's the part I didn't hear. Was that it?
Yeah, well, you know, you go in and you swear on an oath on the Bible, right?
Well, that's not what they do anymore, but you could do that if you wanted,
Yeah, they throw one out at you, and you don't know what kind it is. It could be a Catholic Bible or whatever, some kind of book. Anyway.
That's why you should bring your own, Fred, bring your own.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. You walk in there with a Quran and a devil Bible, and you throw that down and ask them to swear to that they're going to tell the truth.
Uh-huh.
That way you've got them.
Well, yeah.
Kick the dust off your feet and march out of it.
Well, it's fascinating. You read the federal rules, and so help me God's included in the federal rules of civil procedure. You can look it up on the internet, and you might read it closely. But it's part of who we are. It is part of history. It's part of what we've always demanded. It is an act of worship to swear. Why? Well, because when you swear to something, you are deeming that something worthy. Worthyship. And worship is a contracted word. It just means worthyship. So when you swear, you're deeming the one to whom you swear, or the one by whom you swear, rather, worthy to wreak his vengeance on you if you don't keep it. It's putting yourself in his hands. Therefore, the old confessions, for example, Westminster says that the oath, the taking of an oath, is an act of Christian worship. And it is, because he doesn't let you take it by nobody else but him. And if you do, you pay a price. So we should be careful and understand what the oath is. That's the first step. And once you understand what the oath is, you begin to realize this is a big part of life, and it's an important part of our government. And those that founded our country saw it that way, and why wouldn't we? I do. I see it that way. Don't be swearing generally. Don't be swearing loosely. Don't be swearing haphazardly, casually. That's what the word olos means when Jesus Christ do not swear, and then it's translated at all. The word, the Greek word, is olos, and it means generally, without any limits, without casually, just off the cuff. Never do that. Be very careful about what you swear to, and then take it very serious after you do it, because you're asking, if you're doing it right, you're asking the supreme judge of all the world to bring his consequences on you if you don't keep your oath. Back to you, Fred, or
Well, thank you very
George.
Much for that. I don't want his wrath, trust me.
Oh, we've got enough of that, I agree.
The book of Daniel is written looking forward, and there's a point in Daniel they close up the book.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I'm not an expert on the book of Daniel. I'm just enjoying translating it. I've read it for years.
Yeah, but there's another book. There's another book that is a parody to Daniel, but it's looking back in time.
And what's that, Fred?
I think it's Revelation.
Oh, I see what you had mentioned that before. Yeah, that's a great observation.
And sometimes Revelation can explain some of Daniel, and Daniel can explain some of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Revelation...
Well, no question. Yeah, I see your point there.
In Revelation, there's a part that they seal up the book as well.
Oh, let me say one more thing, Fred, and anyone else listen. These comments that I'm making about the oath are my comments, and I am the one that's saying them. That does not mean necessarily that everybody in Liberty Alliance, National Liberty Alliance, takes the same view of the oath. And if somebody, of course, wants to, that hears here, they can take their opportunity to say what they say. But I don't want to foist that idea, because I don't know what everybody believes about the oath. I'm firm on my convictions about it. But if other people take other points of view, I don't want to say that this is the position of those principles and leaders of National Liberty Alliance.
Well, likewise, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist.
Okay, I understand,
I'm part of the Remnant Church. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there to go to church on Sunday, and they don't want to honor part of the Ten Commandments, and to their peril, I believe.
Well, hey, I'm aware of that. Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if that's another reason that they discourage affidavits in court, because you're swearing, it's a sworn statement, and they have to deal with that, you know, because So an affidavit, you're swearing to the statement if you're doing it right. If the notary is doing it right, you're supposed to swear that everything in that is true.
Yes. And that stands with the Bible, too. The Bible says, Paul the Apostle in the New Testament says, as a matter of law, the oath ends the inquiry. He says that. Well, that's the same thing true in our courts fundamentally. When you put in an affidavit or swear to something, unless evidence comes to overcome your oath and what you've said, then that should be. I hasten to add, it always isn't, though. The courts don't do it that way, but they should say, well, this is true. There has been no evidence presented to contravene what this affidavit says. And that should end the matter. Now, it is important to put in an affidavit sometimes, and I know they sometimes are a little proudful, but with summary judgment, for example, you've got to put in an affidavit. If you don't, you won't get anywhere. And when somebody then, when the government, for example, files for summary judgment, if you don't put in an affidavit counteracting what they've said in their motion for summary judgment, the facts, that motion will be granted. I can't say that strong enough. I've learned some hard lessons about that. So remember, the oath and the sworn statement is still important. It can save your case. But nobody's going to tell you that. They certainly aren't going to tell you.
All right.
In a summary judgment. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I want to move to the next guy. We're kind of getting a little late here, and I want to make sure we get everybody this time. So
thank you.
I'm going to go ahead.
Thank you, Fred. Yeah.
Okay. We got, I believe, Terry from New Jersey. Go ahead.
Hi, George. It's Terry.
Hey.
I was just wondering about the thing that Crystal brought up before regarding the executive order of December 21st. I'd like to get the view of Brent with regard to Section 13 on this order, which says, this order is not intended to and does not create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law or in equity by any party against the United States, its departments, agencies, or entities, its officers, employees, or agents, or any other person. So it's kind of ambiguous because it doesn't address, you know, state.
I can't hear you very well. I'm sorry. And then there was some rattling in the background. So did you ask a question at the end?
Yeah, because I'm wondering, did you understand what I said? Because it seems kind of ambiguous, because it basically says that, according to my understanding, and we've discussed this decision at infinitum on that Wednesday night call with regard to the fact that it says what it says. It's not intended to or does not create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law or in equity by any party against the United States, its departments, agencies, or entities, its officers, employees, or agents, or any other person. So it sounds like it's blanket immunity.
What's the name of this executive order?
This is the one that everybody's talking about, Trump's executive order from December 21st.
Oh, okay. I've got it in front of me here. I've never read it. So I thought, well, you're talking about it. It must be something important. I better read it. Is that now what you – yeah, I have Section 13. This order is not intended to and does not create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law, in equity, by any party against the United States. Oh, I see what he's saying. Well, what he's saying is this isn't law. And no executive order is law. He can't. Executive orders are written to his employees, his bureaucrats. It is to limit what they do or order them to do something. For instance, if the President of the United States, as the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, orders a stand-down or he orders a deployment of troops to Afghanistan, those are executive orders. That's what an executive order is. It's the President of the United States or a governor of a state giving orders to those within his jurisdiction of authority. And sometimes they're used in wrong ways, but that doesn't mean that they're anything more than him telling other people how he wants them to go about enforcing the laws of the United States. That's what an executive order is. So an executive order is not legislation. It doesn't create any new laws, but he wants to make sure he says that here. It looks to me like, I'm looking at it, just says that so nobody will think that that's what he's doing. But he does want to. Let's see. Well, it's not that long. I could read it. By authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and laws of the United States of America. And then he talks about the different acts. I, President Trump, find that the prevalence of severity of human rights abuse or corruption that have their source in whole part outside the United States, he's talking about. Maybe I just need to read this. Maybe Gerard, can you comment more upon what he's saying? Because I have to say I haven't contemplated this. Either Gerard is hit the wrong button, or
I had my mic muted. I'm sorry there.
I do the same thing. But at any rate, are you familiar with this? And can you comment on it?
We just started looking at it and thought about ways that we could use his executive order for some of the stuff that's going on in the courts because it's attached to exactly what he's talking about here.
Uh-huh.
So since he's gone after these people for the things that they're doing, you know, and made an executive order and directed, if you go down further, where he said how they should be enforced by the Secretary of State and the authorities of the state, and how this thing down through the states and gives authority for those lower people on how they will enforce it. So to me, this is a very open-ended thing because it's a sweeping declaration. Now, I understand, like you said, this is to his employees. Well, when we find his employees doing these things down in our courts and in our counties, I don't see why we can't point back to this executive order that the president made saying that these people are engaged in crimes and treasons, and this order freezes up their money and puts them under investigation. It says that they will be. You know,
I see
so
now.
These attorneys and these banks that are in there, I'm telling you, if you follow the money of what they're doing, it's all connected. Look at we put in paperwork for the death of Loy Finnegan, and when we first started this, we didn't know what Uranium One was. We didn't know that Hillary Clinton was complicit and directly involved in it, but she was and she is, and so this order here about those people doing those things is very connected to our case of Lavoie Finicum, you know.
Yes.
So I don't know. You know, we're thinking that there's got to be some power here that we can rest on this thing and say, look, you're part of these people that the president's talking about, and also they should include you in the investigation and in the prosecution. And so that would, you know, that way there the judges would take notice that, you know, hey, maybe I better be careful about how I help these evil lawyers and doing the things that they're doing, taking the people's homes away based on, you know, what's going on here. And we have this active executive order now, this national emergency going on. And so, you know, look, if Donald Trump needs a mandate of the people, he puts an order out. We're putting papers in the court, and we're pointing back to the order that he made saying, look, this is what we found what we've brought to the court is exactly what your executive order says. So we want to draw lines between that and our cases because they're there. They need to be drawn.
Uh-huh.
So that's all we're saying, is that, you know, that this would add some power and credibility to our cases where it fits. And I think in a lot of cases, it fits, especially if you do a little investigation and find out who's paying who and who's doing what. It's so deep and so perverse that the stuff that Donald Trump's talking about in Washington, I dare say, rolls right down into your little town, and the monies that are changing hands and the federal monies, that the grants and the things that are going on in our counties and our towns, and how they're administering them and how they're stealing from them and how they're foreclosing based on them, you know, because they give people grants and monies and then they turn around and they use that bait on the hook to suck people into this so they can steal away from them. You know, even when they write these mortgages, knowing that the people can't pay them back. As a matter of fact, there was one bank that financed or claimed they were going to have all this work coming in an area, and they gave people loans based on the jobs they were going to have in this scam work that they never meant to finance and was never really coming in there. And they wrote loans that they knew the people couldn't pay back because they knew they were going to bundle them up and sell them to China, and they just wrote them to write them to make a windfall profit for themselves. So there was a type of RICO there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Now, I see, Terry, you're saying that, what section was it here, section 13, that says that it can't be used against government employees? Or I get my glasses here. I can't read this.
That's what it says.
Terry, what was that section you were reading so I can jump down to it?
Okay, section right here. It says, the order is not intended to and does not create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law or in equity by any party against the United States, its departments, agencies, or entities, its officers, employees, or agents, or any other person. So it sounds like it pretty much covered everything.
Yeah, it does. And also, I take it that he's just saying in this order what our Constitution says. He has no legislative power to do such things. He looks like he's just reiterating that. Because only Congress has the power to make law respecting the general government in Washington, D.C. And so he says, I can't do that. I can't change due process. That's procedural, it says. Substantive, I can't create crimes or rights. I can't change equity. He can't create any. He doesn't have the power to do this. That's why he's saying it. It doesn't have to be said. He did say it. He can't. He can't
do that. That doesn't mean what he's saying is like what Brent says. It's not. It doesn't create any new right, but it's pointing to what they're doing against the laws of the United States and the Constitution. So this is not outside of that. In other words, it doesn't create any right, benefit, or procedural or enforceable law or equity by any party against the United States' departments. Well, it didn't create anything new. They've already broke the existing law. In other words, they're under this executive order not because of this executive order created something that they're not holding to. No, they have broken the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, including all these International Emergency Economic Powers Act and blah, blah, blah. The order didn't do that. They did that. And these acts are the law that was created that addresses their crime. So this order isn't creating any kind of new crime or any situations that we could say that we're going to hold against the government based on this order. No, the order's saying, look, you've broken the laws of the land, and you're doing, you've done it this way, and if you've aided and abetted any of these people that have done these things, then you too can be gone after. So, but that's not a get out of jail free card, there, Terry. It's like Brent says, he doesn't even have to say that, but he did say it to be safe, right? So it doesn't look like he's being a dictator making new law. I guess that's the way I'm taking it, right, Brent?
That's the way I take it, too. That'd be my understanding, and it seems clear. And this is tightly, he's saying, here's our targets. I'll give you their names, and I'll give you their birth dates, so there's no mistake about who these targets of the federal government are. He has drawn a crosshair on these 13 men. This is specific to the hilt. He's saying, we're not going to let these fellows do any financial transactions. We're going to block them. We're going to, oh, you've got it all laid out here. Property and interest in property are blocked pursuant to this order. Who might have, this is interesting, a constitutional presence in the United States. And I'm not sure what that means. I'll have to think about that. I find that the ability to transfer funds or other assets instantaneously prior notice to such persons of measures to be taken pursuant to this order would render these measures ineffectual. I therefore determine, I, Donald Trump, in other words, that for these measures to be effective in addressing the national emergency declared by this order or in this order, there need be no prior notice of a listing or determination made pursuant to this order. He's going after their property. This isn't the first time this has happened. I remember when Jimmy Carter was president, and those fellows were holding hostages over there in the sand land on the other side of the world. He beat them to the punch, and he froze their assets. I remember hearing it on the radio right when it happened. And there have been a lot of times that presidents have done this kind of thing. This is nothing new, nothing unusual, but in this particular case, he's very particular. All property and interest in property that are in the United States, Section 1A, that hereafter come within the United States or that are hereafter come within the possession or control of any United States persons of the following persons are blocked and may be transferred, may not be transferred, paid, exported, withdrawn, or otherwise dealt in. He's saying, I don't care who has possession of this money, even if it's Brent Winters. We are going to block that any transfer of that money, and we're going to freeze it right where it is. We don't care if
he's kind of doing it in rem, too, because he's saying you don't have to notice them. And the reason he's saying he doesn't have to notice them, because if you notice them, they'll run and take the money. It'll be gone by the time they get there.
Yeah, it's like a Jeopardy assessment with the IRS. They just come get your property because they're afraid
that's
you're
right.
Yeah, now, but he cites all the law under which he does it here. Go ahead, George.
Right. And these entities that he is talking about in the annex, I thought it said in here, anybody who aided them, abetted them, or had business with them, like you're saying, even if Brent Winters has the money, they're coming after that. Well, it turns out that these corporations are all the ones that our congressmen, senators, and our the rat politicians are using. These guys are doing their dirty work, and they're connected to it. And what you'll find out is that they have been funded by certain banks and certain entities that go right down into your house, even. This stuff, it looks like if they're from Burma and Gambia and Ukraine and this and that, and that's why the other side didn't realize that. Look, these are the people that are running the rat lines for Clinton, the child pedophilia and stuff. These are the guys that were supplying the children and bringing the money. And then the money gets laundered back here through these different corporations. And so they didn't realize when he put this order out that he was talking about them, because they're doing business with MK Ultra as their enforcer. And guess what? All these Ramez and Gustavo Isdemont Kapavarvija and nationality from Uzbekistan. Well, guess what? They're all in. They've been colluding with people like our Secretary of State and certain other ones, certain people who we won't name, you know, and one particularly who's dying now, you know.
You know, it says here too, Gerard, in A3, that any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and Attorney General, and he includes in that any entity, including any government entity that is engaged in or whose members have engaged in any of the activities described in subsection blah, blah, blah of this section. where the activity is conducted by a foreign person. So it sounds like, because he doesn't, he's saying any entity of government here in the United States and any other entity of government in the world, if they're involved, it doesn't make any difference. If this property or rights and property or these fellows listed here at the end will come in, it makes no difference who you are, a corporation, a person, a government entity.
There you go. Or to be a current or former government official or a person acting for or on behalf of such an official who is responsible for or complicit in or has directly or indirectly engaged in corruption, including the misappropriation of state assets, the exportation of private assets for personal gains, corruption related to government contracts, and the extradition of national resources, there's Uranium One, or bribery, or this is all what's going on in our states right now. The stealing of houses, things, these guys are, this is all misappropriation of funds and robo-signing and all this. It's all connected back as far as I can see. So,
and
I think this,
go ahead, George. I'm sorry.
It's a lot further reaching than the average person knows.
And it says in Section 13, and I'm seeing this more now as I'm looking at it, it says this order is not intended to create any right or benefit against the United States. Well, that still doesn't do away. That does not cancel out and is not opposite to what he says up here about government entities. That's the way I'm reading it now anyway. In other words, if government entities are involved in this problem, they're not exempt from whatever we have to do what this order says. Well, there you go. Sounds like it's pretty wide-reaching. That doesn't exempt anybody. I hope that's the case.
Right. Well, that's why I'm saying that I think we could use it and apply it to these people that are doing these things, because if you follow the money, you're going to find that they're all connected together.
Uh-huh.
This order doesn't make the United States government, the part of it that's doing the right thing, liable. In other words, we can't get a benefit from the government because those people that were acting under color of law that stole our house, that's not those people are personally liable. We can't sue the government and expect them to, pay us or give us a benefit because of this. We have to go after those people and their assets. That's what he's freezing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He's just saying, I'm going to use the law. This executive order, like all executive orders should be, here's the law, and he lists it, and I'm going to use this law because it gives me authority to do the following things, and here's the fellows that the law gives me the authority to do it against, and I'll list them for you. And so he lists them. Well, this looks pretty tightly drawn. Of course, probably he could add to the list if he wanted, but anybody that's connected with these fellows, wittingly or unwittingly, you wouldn't even know it, maybe. Maybe a bank has their money and they're in an account and they don't know that these fellows are criminal. You're saying it doesn't make any difference. We can come into the bank and take it or block it. Well, anyway, I'm glad that it was brought to my attention.
HSBC Bank, which was the Bank of China, which was doing fraud here, was covered up by Comey.
Oh, man.
That would include what this executive order is going after.
Yeah.
And they did all kinds of stuff over here with mortgages and fraud and robo-signing and all that. HSBC. Billions and billions of dollars. And they got busted for it, but nobody went to jail. Imagine that.
Well, as they say, too big to fail, so too big to jail.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, I hope that answers your question, Terry. That does not, I don't believe, and I think Brent agrees, that doesn't negate what we're talking about here. It just puts it in its proper perspective so that it doesn't become bigger than the Constitution, let's say, or the laws that we have. It's not creating new law.
Well, I appreciate all the time you put in on that question. I have a brief question I want to ask you because this actually involves everybody in every state. And I order, and everybody should do this, they should order, get a copy of your state grand jury manual, because there's some interesting bullshit in here. What?
No, go ahead. I'm laughing because I think we talked about this, but go ahead.
Right. And it says here in the manual, it has been charged that the grand jury is merely the rubber stamp of the prosecutor who allegedly is able to mold the results of its inquiries. The charge that prosecutors abuse their powers in grand jury proceedings is unsubstantiated in this state. In point of fact, instances of prosecutorial misconduct are rare in New Jersey. Nevertheless, we believe that a comprehensive compilation of grand jury procedures presently utilized throughout the state will benefit law enforcement officers and ensure public confidence in our criminal justice system. So, you know, they're making this allegation that allegations of misconduct are unsubstantiated. Now, I'm wondering, where do they get this? Did they do a scientific survey or something about that, or just anecdotal evidence, or you know, whatever they pulled out of their ass, which is more likely?
Look at the fact that they're mentioning it means they've got a guilty conscience. It's been said that, you know, the prosecutors can, you know, taint the jury, but not maybe every place else, but not in New Jersey. New Jersey's pristine. We all know that. Just ask Chris Christie. He'll tell you.
I know.
Anyway.
And the funny thing about it is why everybody should read this is because I was indicted by a grand jury. And after reading this, I realize now that the prosecutor completely violated his own book.
Yeah,
well, remember what Henry Hyde said after he was the head of the Judiciary Committee in Congress, and they did their study on the grand jury, because it was obvious that federal grand juries were rubber stamps for prosecutors. And he said, after all that evidence put before the committee, he said a United States attorney with a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. And I believe it to be true. Now, New Jersey is not the feds, but I have a hard time believing that New Jersey, as you said, is pristine on this point. Doesn't stand to reason.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But you would expect the government to say that. They never admit to doing wrong. I mean, in such rare instances, it wouldn't make any difference.
And if they're making a point of denying it, I would say they're definitely doing it.
that's true.
You know what I mean? It's like, everybody else might be doing it, and that might be their reputation, but not us.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got a vested interest.
I'm going to write to the prosecutor's office and find out, ask them, how do they make that determination? And if I get a response, I'm going to follow it up with the members of the legislature, how can they possibly make this? What is it based on?
Well, you know, they do their outcome-based testing or survey to get to a certain outcome. So it's they put a questionnaire out there to get the results that they want. That's how they come to those conclusions.
They're going to the prosecutors to ask for this information. What do you think they're going to say?
Exactly. Oh no, not us. We do everything according to the book.
You know, the grand juries, or the people on the grand jury, there's been studies done like this in past decades. The people on the grand jury, most of them, believe and are convinced, without even saying it, that the prosecutor is their lawyer. He's fighting for them. We're paying his wages. We trust him. I've even read grand jury transcripts where the U.S. attorney would tell them something, and the foreman, this is in the transcript, said, whatever you say, we trust you, and we're all behind you. I read that right in the transcript. Now, that doesn't invalidate anything the grand jury does to those kind of statements, but it certainly reveals a problem that we all should be aware of, and if we're on a grand jury, we should do something about it. We should take control. And if necessary, investigate the prosecutor.
Well, if you're a grand jury foreman or you're a grand juror and you know, you have a prosecutor, you know, that you think's doing that, you have to ask him to leave so that you can talk, because he should not be present for all your deliberations when he's bringing the charges.
Yeah.
And he should leave the room, and then that way you're free to say, I think he's full of baloney. You know what I mean? I think we need to look into this or that, and let's get another source in here to get the other side of the story.
You know, the grand jury has absolute power to do what they want. If they don't want to follow the rules of evidence, they don't have to. And by the way, they never do. Now, I'm talking on the federal level. That's where I've had experience.
Mm-hmm.
The people on the grand jury don't have to do anything they don't want to do. But if the people on the grand jury want the rules of evidence to be followed, and they want a little fairness, and they want to hear the other side, that's absolutely their prerogative. They can do anything they want in that respect. They can demand what they want. They can demand, like you said, to get the prosecutor out. They can investigate the prosecutor and start demanding that he's under investigation. They can investigate anything they want. They're wide open. It's a free-for-all in the grand jury. That's why grand jurors need to understand they have a tremendous power, a power to ignore the rules of evidence. Of course, the people that are being investigated, the only attorney that's allowed in front of the grand jury is the prosecutor. I don't know that that's so smart. If you're representing somebody as a lawyer, you're not allowed to come into the grand jury room. You can sit outside the room and tell your client to come out and ask you a question anytime he wants if you need advice, but you can't go in there. So, man, the reason it doesn't matter, as they say, is because the rules of evidence don't matter if the grand jury doesn't want to follow them. And they never do, never. Of course, you wouldn't expect them to. But then the U.S. attorney goes in and he breaks all the rules of evidence. And or whether he is the prosecutor or the prosecutrix. Prosecutrix, he may be a he, may be a she. Now, they're adept at breaking the rules and doing the unethical thing. They're very good at it. And they're not called into question because even if you bring it up by reading the grand jury transcripts, the judge still say, well, that's none of my business what the grand jury does. I'm just here to enforce the request of the grand jury, and that's good. He's not involved. He's not part of it. But if they do want something and they can't get something they've subpoenaed, then they'll ask the judge to enforce their subpoena. That can be done. That, of course, brings in the U.S. Marshal and the club and the blackjack and the jail, all those kind of things. So that's not so bad. But the grand jury has power. Trouble is that power, because of the ignorance and the lack of confidence of grand juries, has fallen completely under the spell of U.S. attorneys in the federal courts and prosecutors in the state courts where they're used. That's a problem.
Well, you know, Brent, I was at a Supreme Court hearing earlier this week, or last week, rather. And
wow.
It was a state Supreme Court, not a federal.
Oh, okay.
State, and the guy was going to take a plea bargain. And they went through, do you know that you're giving up this right and that right and this right? And one of the things that they brought up, they said that you can bring witnesses before the grand jury and question them. I was floored. This is New York State.
Uh-huh.
And then on the other hand, we got this article that comes out of, I don't know where, it's an opinion, a New York opinion that says that juries cannot set innocent people free. That there's no jury nullification. I got this article here. It's unbelievable what they're, and they use Marbury versus Madison to shore up their claim that and they say the reason that jury nullification is not allowed is because it undermines the criminal justice system.
I've read those kind of articles too. Lawyers are notorious, the intellectuals as they call them, for saying that the jury should be denied that power. Trouble is, the jury has always had that power, but what hasn't happened is, and this is still the common law rule, once the jury comes into the courtroom being paneled, they can't be educated, they can't be told what their power is. In other words, the policy of our common law has always been, you take the juror as you find him. You don't educate him. Once he gets there, you can educate him before he gets there if you want. You can get on television, radio. You can hold seminars. You can have conference calls. But Once he gets there, if you try to educate him, that's jury tampering. And that our common law doesn't allow. That's why it's important that the people of the United States and the people of the several states know what the jury is, understand what the fight's about. This fight goes back to a case in England, Justice Mansfield, right about the time our country was formed. Justice Mansfield was chief judge. And the question was, does the jury, in the end, this is what was appealed on, does the jury have power to ignore the law, or do they truly have authority to ignore the law? Well, nobody, even today or back then, ever questioned the power of the jury to come back against the law and ignore the law. People have always believed that. But the debate and the fight has been over whether or not the jury has authority to do that. There's a difference between authority and power. If a police officer follows the law, he has authority. If he breaks the law in what he does, he doesn't have authority, but he certainly has power to do what he did. The Nazis didn't have, and the Japanese didn't have authority to abuse prisoners. I just was reading a thing the other day about the 50 officers that the Nazis ordered to be shot. They were caught, they escaped, and they killed them all, just gunned them down like animals. Well, they had the power to do that, and they did it, but they had no authority. And many men hung for what happened, too, in the end, at the war crime trials, over that particular point. Well, the same thing is true of a jury. Does a jury have just the power to ignore the law, to set it aside? Or do they also have the authority? Justice Mansfield said they do have the power, clearly, but they don't have the authority. And Justice, I believe his name, I won't say his name, I don't remember, but he disagreed. There was a dissent, a strong one. He said, that's ridiculous. If you can't punish the jury for setting aside the law, and you can't, by the way, that's clear too, then they do have the authority. But to say they don't have the authority, but you have no way of enforcing that, then that's a waste of time. But the fascinating thing about all this is that we in our common law country, in our common law tradition, have never come to a conclusion, a clear establishment of whether or not the jury has authority to disregard the law. But we have come to a conclusion and said they clearly have the power. Now, where does Brent stand? Well, Brent's with that other justice. That's clear. I think Mansfield, as smart as he was wrong. Clearly, if you have the power, and I can't punish you for doing it, then you have the authority, too. And Justice Holmes of the United States Supreme Court said that the jury clearly can bring their verdict in the teeth of the law. He put it in a memorable way. I'm glad he did. In the teeth of the law, but he didn't distinguish between power and authority. And then some people say, I guess there is a third position. Who cares? If they can do it, they can do it. I don't care what you call it. Well, there's some merit to that, too. So let's just know this as Americans, I tell people. The jury can disregard the law and bring their verdict in opposite to what the law says if the jury wants to. And as a matter of law, there's nothing anybody can do about it. And if where it needs to be done, it needs to be done. And for somebody to say that that's not possible, it destroys the common law jury, because that has always, for centuries, that's what juries have done. Back to you, Gerard. I'm talked out on that one. If you're there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm here. Yeah. I'm just reading this case here about, you know, the juries and what the courts, New York courts have said. It's pretty interesting. New York trial courts have mandated duty to prevent improper, impermissive nullification conduct. It has long been recognized in our jurisprudence that it is the jury's duty to be governed by the instructions of the court as to all legal questions. They have the power to do otherwise, but the exercise of such power cannot be regarded as rightful. Oh, imagine that.
That's exactly what Justice Mansfield said, see?
Mm-hmm.
Rightful authority. I'm surprised. They're clear. They've hit the nail on the head as to the question of the jury then. That's exactly the argument that's been going on for centuries.
Criminal jury instructions in no uncertain terms inform jurors that it is their duty to follow the law as explained by the court. Generally, if it is established during voir dire that a prospective juror is unwilling to do so, that juror may be excused for cause. Well, you know, that's another way that they stack the juries, too. You know?
That's right. That is right. And they do it everywhere, even where it's not. They'll say, well, you took an oath to do what the judge says. Now, how ridiculous can that be? Let's quit messing around.
Why do you need a jury then?
I take an oath to do what somebody says, and I haven't heard them say it yet. Come on.
Yeah.
So I take an oath in good faith that the judge is going to instruct me as to the law right. I hear what he says, and I realize he's a loon. The judges go mad. Judges do not know everything. That's why we have juries. Let's get off the stupidity here. And so if somebody takes an oath, and then all of a sudden they listen to the judge give them the instruction, they say, wait a minute, that ain't right. And they go against it. They have not broken their oath. See, what they'll tell you, and prosecutors say this, hey, if you don't do what the judge says in this case, you have violated your oath. Well, you know what that means. That means the vengeance of God will come down on you. They use that on juries. I've heard them do it. But that is not true. Under this principle, no man has a right to do wrong. Once you've discovered that your oath is unlawful, the Reformation was built on this point. Why? Well, put it bluntly. In our own tradition, there were a lot of nuns and a lot of men and monks, a lot of monks that had taken oaths that they would go inside the walls of those institutions and never come out and do everything they were told to do. And when they discovered in their conscience that that was unlawful, that that oath they took was not a lawful oath, they had a duty to disregard it. And that's one of the things we find in the Westminster Confession when Parliament asked the clergy of England and Scotland advice on legislation and what they should say, and they made that point. And they have a section in there, in the confession, called unlawful oath. An unlawful oath, even if you take an oath and you know it's unlawful, and then you finally decide, doggone it, I can't go through with this. And so you back up and disregard your oath. And God requires you to do that if your oath is unlawful. For example, the book of Acts, there was a group of men there that took a blood oath to murder the Apostle Paul, and they swore that they would not eat or drink until he was dead. They were Jews. It was the oath of the Jews. It was a Babylonian oath. Now, if any one of those, then an oath to do wrong is unlawful. Maybe you don't understand it was wrong. Maybe you come to that understanding. And once you do, you have a duty. It's called withdrawal. Whatever the case, we want people to feel free if they've committed themselves to commit a crime or do a wrong. Our common law says, no, you've got a duty to back out once you understand it or once you're convicted that it's wrong, you got to back out. So this argument that prosecutors give to jurors to say, well, you took an oath to follow the instructions of the judge is meaningless. And it is a travesty. And it is an unlawful thing for a lawyer to do. It is a violation of his oath to do that. And if he's doing it, if there's any of you listening, you need to stop. Judges, lawyers, whoever you are, that is a violation of your oath to even say that. Back to you, Gerard.
Okay, I want to get moving here a little bit. But, you know, I was going to say, you know, you brought up a point that kind of runs against some of what we've been talking about, the administrators to the juries, because one of the part of our plan is that when we're going to educate jurors on the Constitution for 8 hours, and you just said that you got to take the juror as he comes, you're not allowed to educate him until, you know, you got to educate him before you pick him, you know, How are you going to give these jurors eight hours of instruction? They're going to say that you're tainting them, right?
Oh, I'm not understanding what you're saying. I was making the point, if you're going to educate a juror, you've got to do it before he gets to the courthouse and is being considered for the jury pool. That's what I was saying. Is that the way you understood it?
Yeah, and part of what NLA's plan was is these court administrators who are going to administer and pick the juries and administer the juries to the court, is to give them a course on jury nullification and the Constitution and blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? According to tradition and the thing, we're not allowed to do that.
Well, and I see that. Yeah, I see your point. And I'm not against doing it. I'm just saying that's the way the law stands now. And I know fully informed jury says we need to tell them. You know, it's all ignored by the government. I've been to courthouses where they get ready for a jury trial and they show the jury a film. Well, that's tampering with the jury. Why do that? Yeah. Well, they say, well, hey, here's what a juror is. Here's your duty. And they want, so they're really educating them. So where do you draw the line with this? Now, if the Fully Informed Jury Association, they want to make it mandatory that the jury, that the judge instructs the jury that they have the authority and the power to disregard the law. Well, I'm not against that. And I'm, matter of fact, it seems like a good idea to me. And people say, well, if we do that, we'll have chaos. Well, maybe. I don't know. And could we get any more chaotic than we are now? I'm not against what you're saying. I'm just saying that's been the position of the common law.
Right,
and that doesn't mean, remember, the common law, as we understand it, is constituted by the observations of men. And if it, and sometimes the observations and what is applicable needs to be re-expressed, as I'd said at the beginning tonight, we are constantly re-expressing, re-saying the same first principles, trying to get them right. Sometimes we don't get them just right. And that's why we have the law written in the Bible as the final rule of practice. It's written, it's frozen, it's fixed where it is, and we can go to it and evaluate it very particularly. And that's why Blackstone calls it the particular revelation of God, whereas the other is called historically men have always said this, the laws of nature, which are common laws of significant slice, are the general revelation of God. That's different than the particular revelation. Back to you, George.
Right. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to move on here, but one more point. We had one of our members that went to court, and he had jury pamphlets for educating the jury, and he asked the judge if it would be okay if he gave them those pamphlets that talked about the jury's powers, and the prosecutor was all upset. He objected. He jumped up and down. The judge says, no, calm down. He says, you can't give it to them here in the court. He said, but if you catch them outside the court, you feel free. And I think that's pretty good, a New York judge saying that, because I got arrested for handing things out to the jury outside of court. So maybe there's some change blowing in the wind here. Anyway, just thought that would be interesting. So I'm going to go ahead. Thank you, Terry. I'm going to move ahead to Tara from New York. Go ahead, Tara. You've been unmuted.
Oh, very, very interesting conversation tonight.
Yeah.
Yes. This is Tara, the now newly elected senator of the Republic for the Nation State of New York. And I just wanted to let you know that we have completed our Committee of States for our group Beacon 37, and we've noticed the world that 43 states are now in the lawful republic. So in my state particularly, I am working on doing grand juries. I have a petition signed by 200 of our constituents, and we have elected four county notaries, which are taking the position of the position that was the ancient civil position, which was the scribe, as well as the justice of the peace and the judge. So we have elected four people for that position, and we are looking to join a grand jury for a few of our cases, especially with dealing with foreclosures. So this will be the first attempt by our constituency to do such a thing. And I'd like to get with the grand jury from New York and see if we can work together and bring our ideas together. Because
Well, Tara, we are setting up. We don't have grand juries per se. I mean, we're operating as a grand jury seated on the big case that we've opened up, but we don't have any local grand juries picked, because the trouble with picking a grand jury and saying we're the grand jury is then you have a grand jury that's seated forever, and that's not good. That makes misuses. I mean, we found cases where a grand jury foreman served for 30 years, and you can't do that because it's not impartial then. So we're not actually picking juries or grand juries per se. What we're doing is we want to get four administrators per county that are gonna administer juries and grand juries and educate them and make sure that they operate within the law. You know what I mean? And make sure there's no jury tampering in the, you know, when the judge gives the instruction. So that we're not really picking grand juries at this point. There's no seated grand juries other than the one that we have right now, which includes all of us in every state in this one case that we put in our master case, and we're going to stay seated until that case is accepted and prosecuted by a prosecutor. So that grand jury is in session, which is something we created called the unified grand jury. You know, they have the unified court system, and so we created the unified grand jury of the United States in order to bring all these abuses forward into the Congress and the president and have them, you know, prosecuted under the law. But we're not really picking juries, seated juries per se at this point. Committees of safeties are great because they will end up being juries and grand juries in particular local stuff that goes on. But until you have a case that needs to be, you know, investigated or whatever, that's when a jury gets picked. And of course, you know, we've tried to go in the courtrooms to act as juries when we started this thing way back when, I don't know what it was, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and they would not let us in. They refused to give us a room, and so that's part of why our case is in the federal court. You know, and I don't know, have you read U.S. versus Williams as far as the relationship between the grand jury and the courts? That's a very important to know that. And basically, okay, he says it's up to the people. You know, they're almost like a fourth branch of government because, yes, you have to operate under the auspices of a court. That's why we went and got a number and put our cases into court, because we're not going to do like some of these other people have done that are now sitting in jail because they started their own courts and their own judges and their own things outside of the system that's in existence now. Look, at our system has problems. We know we have voter fraud. We know that we have corruption and all that. But yet it's the system, the court is open, like Brent said. It's up to us to go in there and enforce the law. The cure for lawlessness is the law. We can't say, okay, we're going to open our own court in Denny's here, and we're going to arrest people and we're going to try them in Denny's. Well, you know, the only way you can do something like that is if we were under attack. That would be martial law, and then you're going to, that ends up being military tribunals. It's just chaos. Right now, we're pushing our way back into our courts that they've stolen from us. But we're not appointing people or electing people of our own. You know, there was a group there. They had judges and marshals and all this stuff, and they wanted us to go with them to the court and arrest the judge. You know, in the Bundy case. And I said, what are you? You're crazy. You know, what are you? You're going to try to start a revolution? You know, we have marshals. I said, well, what marshals? Well, they had some kind of postal rule that they thought that they could. You know, I was calling them Captain Crunch Dakota Ring judges and marshals because that's basically what they were doing. You know, so you have to be careful.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, our group is fully seated as a republic. We are noticed by the privatized Hague, by the UPU, by the UN, by the United Nations now.
Who all we have no authority within the borders of the United States. Those are foreign entities. technically, if you're going to Hague and the UN and this and that, and then seated here in New York State, you could be considered a subversive organization from a foreign entity. You're a foreign entity. The UN, look at, the UN doesn't have authority. We don't want UN troops here. We can't go looking to the UN and to the Hague to fix our problems. We need to fix our problems here in our courts. We need to get rid of bad judges and get them out. Donald Trump has really started the ball rolling, whether people understand it or not. And it's up to us that what we're doing by filing our case in the court, we're not going to The Hague and filing a case. I don't know if you remember that guy that was trying to get us into the Hague. And I mean, he was, look, at, I don't say he was a bad dude or anything like that. He was worried about child trafficking and they went to the world court and all that, which is, that's great. But see what Donald Trump did here with this executive order? He did do it through the UN. First he did the Constitution, and then he used those treaties that we have through the UN that says, look at, we've all agreed under this pact, under this treaty or whatever you want to call it, that anybody that's doing these things to children or running money this way for drugs and abusing our laws, that we will freeze their assets wherever they are, whether they're in the United States or out of the United States, and all the countries agree to it. That's different. That's different than trying to get a Hague court to come over here and tell people what to do.
Oh, no, we just noticed the Hague. We're not working with the Hague. We just sent them our general assemblies for 43 states. We just let them know just out of courtesy. But we are fully seated as a government, as a lawful republic, which is something that was requested of us by a couple of people. But I just wanted to let you know that we have completed what we said we were going to do. And now I believe that as a senator, I can operate as a United States official. I mean, by being the fact that we are the only real lawful government that's in existence right now, because everything else is corporate. So, I mean, even the Pentagon had requested Jim Wright to do this particular task, and we completed 43 states. You know, so I just want you to know that we will be able to operate without having to go under their index numbers. Because we're common law, we're Article 3 at this point, because we're taking it all the way back to, I mean, right after the Articles of Association, we're taking it from the Articles of Confederation up where we're getting our jurisdiction. You know, so I want
to... Well, look, our Article 3 court has authority, and they're supposed to give it to us in the Constitution, and I agree that there's this corporate overlay. But you see, that's what we're fighting for, because when you go into the court, they're trying to push you into this civil, statutory, corporate court. But the reason they're able to do that is because people don't understand what's going on, and what happens is they continue on. They don't slap the judges like we do, give them writs of error, and then throw them in the case and get another judge. That's what the battle is. We're coming in to take that court. Now, if you're saying you're coming in as an Article 3, but basically you're establishing a new court and you're going to operate outside of those courts, you're going to have to be real careful, because they can get you for subversion. Because even I understand the corporate overlay that they're violating people's rights, you know, but that's up to us to bring them back to that Article 3 common law court that we're fighting so hard for. You know, I don't know, you know, if Congress would do their job, and of course they're all corrupt, you know. So if you can be elected, if we can elect new congressmen and new senators to do their job, I don't know how you got elected as a senator. I don't know what the election process was, or who oversaw that, or if it's recognized even. I mean, I don't know what that process you used was. I think you need to be real careful about how you go about that. I think it's great.
Well, yeah, we have the whole thing recorded, documented, you know, fully available for anybody who wants to inspect it. And we did share that with the world. As far as 43 states all coming together in one, it took about a two-hour period to do the Committee of States. And we have the whole thing, our paperwork, you know, demonstrates that we completed the task. So, I mean, I don't see why there would be any kind of, you know, discrepancy. Why would anyone argue that we haven't established a fully lawful government? You know, according to the original constitution that was never ratified correctly and is now being ratified in each state. So it's almost like we're doing something that's never been done before, you know, because ever since the statutes at large, they went corporate. You know, they never really took the government for the people, by the people. It was always corporate. So we're really taking it way back, like 1774 even, you know, and it's really establishing a voice for the people and not just the people who were in that room who wrote the Constitution. You know, so it's unprecedented.
I don't believe that those people that were in that room wrote the Constitution just for themselves. And when they said "for us and our prosperity," meant for them and their children. That is propaganda. And basically what you're saying is you have broken the ties that bind you. You're doing a second revolution. You're throwing this government out. You're saying you're making war against this government. And you're saying we're starting a lawfully government. And by saying that the American Constitution was never truly ratified, what you're saying is we never had a Constitution when we absolutely did. Now, I understand there's this corporate overlay, but it's here, and it takes education, and it takes working in that system. You're working outside of that system. I'm telling you, you're on dangerous ground, believe me, because what you're doing is you're basically starting a revolution. You're doing the same thing that our forefathers did, but our forefathers went through a whole process of remonstrating and petitioning and all this other stuff, and that's what National Liberty Alliance is doing. We're moving through the courts, through this system, which we believe that Article 3 court, the writings are still there. There, you look at income tax, Title 26 is not law. But everybody is ignorant, and so they contract into it because they don't know any better. You don't need to start a new government to get rid of income tax. All you got to do is enforce the law. Now, I don't know, Brent, you can jump in anytime you want here, but I don't know how you see. I don't know. Maybe I don't understand where she's coming from as far as what they're doing, but it sounds to me like they're starting a new government, which is a second revolution, which means that that whatever's here now is completely thrown out, which means Donald Trump is not really our president, and we're not recognizing any of them. That could bring us to bullets, as far as I can see.
Well, no, it seems that way to me, too. There's been a lot of times in our own history and in the history of other countries where people have done that, and it didn't usually go anywhere because there was no teeth in it. In other words, the only way our government keeps going is it has an executive branch that enforces what it decides to do. And that force, for example, the President of the United States is in command of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, not to mention all those other people that carry guns and the alphabet soup bureaucracies. By theory, he's in control of them, but we are now learning in a big way that he's not in control of them. They operate outside his authority. On paper, they're in his authority. But at any rate, there's a enforcement power that goes with the government, and people in different parts of... Well, consider, for example, in Israel in the first century, the Israelites said, we've got our own government. And the Rome said, well, we'll let you have your government, but you can try cases. And they did. They tried cases that just had to do with non-criminal matters, but if it was a criminal matter, they had to turn it over to Rome. For example, the execution of Jesus Christ was a criminal matter. If you read the accounts there in the gospel records, you'll see that what they were trying to do was get Rome to go ahead and murder him, because they knew that Rome didn't allow them to do that. They could not administer capital punishment under the law of Rome. But they were operating on their little government in certain ways. We have the same thing here. But churches operate their governments, and business organizations have governments and policy. But what it sounds like this lady's talking about here is putting in place the real government of the United States. I can't comment on it because I don't understand what she's saying has happened. She says she's a senator. I don't know how she got to be there. Was due process followed? You know, there is a doctrine to it, common law. To mention one other thing, I know we're getting close to the time. It's not over. We're 1 minute over, but I want to mention this. At common law, this has been true throughout the history of Britain, and if a king was in office unlawfully, but he had the power and he's acting as king, forget the name of the doctrine, but men have a duty to still stay in place and follow the law until they can get him out. Now, when he steps outside of his authority, that's another matter. But a king who's not duly put in office, as Obama, Obama was not duly put in office. In other words, he wasn't even qualified under the Constitution to be president of the United States in more ways than was popularly talked about. But nonetheless, he was in office. He had power. And for the sake of order, the common law would say, let it go on as long as he doesn't break the law. And as I'd said a while ago about Nifiadio, as long as he doesn't do serious harm to you. Well, there have been some presidents that have done some serious harm. Clinton did serious harm. He murdered people. We know now, of course, that Obama, yeah. He murdered people, too, and he wanted the power to do that, and Congress gave it to him. We know that now. Or I know it. Maybe I should have known it sooner. But I don't understand what you're doing exactly, so I can't really comment on it.
Well, we had elections, and we had a general assembly. We have a secretary. We took general assembly notes of the process of how I got to be the delegate first, and then we had a second delegate, who's nominated from our group. So there was due process for each one of the 43 states, and it's all documented. So, but the thing is, I don't believe that we're trying to overrun the existing corporate government. We're working in the private. We're not trying to go out in the public and, elicit the people to impeach Donald Trump or anything like that. We're working totally privately. So we don't go to the public side of the Hague. We go to the private side. But believe it or not, the Pentagon did take notice of what we were doing and did contact us and told us to continue and let us know when you completed that task. So for some reason, because we're noticed at these agencies, the whole world was taking notice of what we were doing. And in France and Italy, they all reacted from the general assemblies that were being filed. So it's going to be interesting because we have established something.
And, well, I'm sure you have, but take notice, if due process were followed, I would have heard about it. Now, France may have heard about it. I didn't hear about it. If I didn't hear about it, I didn't get due process.
Well, yeah, look, the Constitution tells how a president is elected, how the Congress is to be elected, and all that. And you're supposed to, and what portion of the representatives and the electoral college and all that. But, if you don't believe that it was ever set up properly, so then I obviously they didn't use that. They didn't follow that because she doesn't believe it was ever ratified correctly. So
yeah, we don't have a House of Representatives. We only have a Senate, which was the original plan, the original Constitution, before 1776. After that, they took it and ran with it, adding all the House of Representatives, adding all of these corporate type of fictional officials. And they never allowed that first Constitution to really blossom. So that's what we went back to, and that's what they requested. When we did that, the Pentagon took notice. And so for some reason, they think that that's an important thing that was done. And it's going to be revealed to us as we go along because we just noticed them about 2 weeks ago. And the UN, they sent back the paperwork, but then we sent it back to them again. So now, it's not even necessary that we did that, but we did it out of courtesy. And I just want to let you know that this is happening, just to be aware of it, that there will be many people coming to the forum from that group. It was called Beacon 37 at the time we developed it, and it took us about a year and a half to complete this.
Well,
and
look,
you know,
I understand what you're saying, and I kind of know what you did because I knew Kevin Annett, and I know what he did and what he set up, and he did that too through the courts of The Hague, and then he fell apart. Mm-hmm. He had some problems of his own. But just because mm-hmm. you got contacted by somebody in the Pentagon, don't forget, there's black hats and white hats in the Pentagon. We got all kinds of things going on in this nation right now, and they would love to get us under the UN. I wouldn't ask the UN for the time of day. As a matter of fact, I think we need to get out of it. You know, I don't. Mm-hmm. Washington said, do business with them, but don't be policemen. And we've done everything opposite of what our forefathers told us. It wasn't their fault. It's our fault. I know that the fingers of the cabal have been in there since the beginning. The bankers, Andrew Jackson was fighting that central bank, you know, but which we end up losing that battle because we got them. And they're an unconstitutional entity. They don't operate, you know, they don't have any authority to do what they're doing. And we don't audit them, and we don't pick them. And they're just, you know, Congress had no authority mm-hmm. to give away their authority to print money and put the value on. So, look, we've been operating mm-hmm. under bankruptcy, which is, you know, we've got plenty of papers out there that explain this. And it's not an easy fight back, but you have to be very discerning about the paths that you take. And I'm not saying that you're doing bad things, but you have to be careful because people are going to woo you. They're going to put that carrot on a stick, and what they're going to do is they're looking for chaos. They're looking to bring good people against good people. We need to talk because this is important. Because there's
yeah.
stuff going on out there, lots of intrigue, lots of black hats and white hats. So we need to really discuss where we're going and what we're doing and how we're doing it. And with that, mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and end tonight, and we'll bring it up next week. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important that we discuss this and everybody understands exactly, you know, where we are as a nation and as a people, okay?
I'd love to continue. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Pray to God enlightens us because we are definitely at a turning mm-hmm. point here, and we could go either way. We could go off one end or the other end, and you know, evil mm-hmm. is prevalent all over, so, okay?
Yeah, all right, I will pray.
Okay,
then.
Thank you very much.
Good night, then. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody. Bye.